You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I would suggest that these shoes and bare feet, both as being Freemasonic symbols, triggers, but it's also, I would say, possibly like a business card that they leave behind them when these are the operations.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Ole Damegaard and Kevin Barrett. Today's show, The Global Tour of Terror, a theory of false flag operations. Ole Damegaard and Kevin Barrett were panelists on the Deep Truth Visionaries Speak Out online video conference of July 9th, 2018, produced by No Lies Radio. We begin with a presentation by Swedish investigative journalist and author Ole Damegaard on Find the Clues and Connect the Dots, on forensic evidence of manipulated and staged photographs in the media reports of global terror events. Ole Damegaard.
So, I would like to share to you what might be a super boring presentation or something of immense value. I hope the later. But, well, here we go. I call it, like always, a global tour of terror, because this is what I've been tracking down for so many years. And I think that I might have come up with something that can help reveal what is really going on. So, prepare yourself. A global tour of terror, revealing the agenda. So the question is, what is actually going on in the world as such? And also, as with any crime, any violent crime, and so you have to look at the forensic evidence. That is what I've been trying to do, and really find the specific of the leads, the dots, the clues, whatever, that can show us what's really going on. What is the actual truth of different events? And when you look at crimes, I would say sometimes you have to look for, like if it's a serial killer you're tracking down or a serial rapist or so on, you find for similarities, symmetries in the crime scene, similarities, clues that are identical left on different crime scenes and so on, that will help you point out who the guilty part in is in this. And so I've named this presentation, Find the Clues and Connect the Dots. Now, we're being told that the world is filled with Muslim terrorists looking more or less like this, or the legal version underneath. So I ask you, would an fundamentalist group be able to affect Western media? Would they be able to control what images are being used in Western media, in newspapers all over the Western world, or not? I would suggest that that would be way beyond their control. Their part would be blowing themselves up and so on, but they could not affect media in a distinguished way. So let's see, what are we seeing here? And over the years, I've done this for 30-odd years, and one of the things that I found is that I keep running into these shoes. Everywhere where there's an alleged terror attack, there are these shoes that are left there, normally more or less invisible. They're there somewhere in the image, but it's not what you're looking at, but they're always there. And one of the things that I found in my research was that I was contacted by Freemasons that told me that this is actually a Freemasonic sign that shows you one shoe off of a victim or somebody involved. One shoe off means that they're taking part of this operation voluntarily. Two shoes off means that it's a homage to the sacred space where this is being carried out. But it's one step further, I would say, because these shoes appear on so many different areas. And so if we go back in history, the shoes, what are the shoes a sign of? And when you look at in a historical way, the first time I really encountered these shoes were when it comes to the Holocaust, where they have been used massively in history books and so on, where we keep seeing these mountains of shoes of people that are said to have been killed in these death camps and so on. Also, other war zones like the Balkan War and so on, the shoes appear. You got in Honduras, the death squads, the shoes appears and so on. So it seems like the shoes are a sign that keeps being repeated. Then I can really recommend a film, a movie called Wag the Dog. It's a very, very interesting film with Robert De Niro and Dustin Hoffman. And it's about how when a president is in a tricky spot, how they can call in experts and set up a diversion. In this case, it's a movie where it's almost identical to the situation with Bill Clinton in the White House and Monica Lewinsky, and how they needed to divert the attention away from this disaster. And so in the movie, they very realistically create a war that doesn't exist against Albania, because it's so far away that most people in the States haven't even got a clue where it is. So they do that in media. They stage the whole thing, divert the attention away. And one of the key things in this movie is the shoe here as well. They come up with this theme of a shoe. They throw up some shoes over a telephone pole and up in the some trees and so on. They even get Willie Nelson to play a song like they make out. It's like recorded in the 1920s called The Old Shoe. And the hero, the returning war hero that they need also in this drama, they always need heroes when they do the storytelling of these alleged events. And the guy that they bring home, he's played by Woody Harrelson, and he's called The Old Shoe as well. So the shoe is very, very central in this. And I've done many interviews on this theme. And lately, I also done interviews with a CIA, a former whistleblower, former private contractor called Cody Snodgrass, which I think is one of the most important whistleblowers in modern times, at least at this point. Very, very incredible information he's coming out with. And we were doing a show together, and I kept talking about these shoes. And then he said, have you ever thought of that when people are being broken down in mind control experiments, for instance, like they're being created into assassins or fall guys or whatever, what they do in these very brutal methods to create patsies that can be used for whatever, they break them down through horrific torture, sexual abuse, verbal abuse, you name it, absolute pure pain. And while doing it, one of the things they do is they hold up like symbols in front of the person that are being subjected to this horrific treatment. And this symbol, they always use the same symbol for this same individual. It could be like upside down swimming dolphins or wavy lines or whatever. And this then becomes a trigger, like a trigger image that can be used with this individual to trigger him into becoming in that alternative state of mind, or alternative personality can then be used to activate this agent. I mean, they can activate a second part of the personality with a trigger in itself. And Cody said, I believe that these shoes are there as a trigger so that every time we see an alleged terror event or anything horrific that are really fear boosting in the population, they leave these shoes there as a trigger. So I'm asking myself, that made a lot of sense. So I'm asking myself, is this possible? Are these shoes that are left there in so many different images there to trigger us, to keep us in fear mode? And if so, is it being used sort of in an organized way? Is it possible that we're seeing alleged terror attacks, war zones, suicide bombers around the planet that are actually coordinated and are actually where these shoes are left there as a trigger through media to keep the rest of us in massive fear mode, constant fear mode? I ask you, and this is what I would like this presentation to be about. So here we see also articles in the newspapers, they use the shoe what has a shoe to do anything with a terror attack? For instance, here, which countries have had the most terrorist attacks? What on earth has a shoe to do with that? If I used to work as a photographer and journalist. If I'd come home with a photo of a shoe after an alleged terror attack, I would have get my butt kicked. I mean, I would have been fired saying, what were you thinking? I mean, come on, get a photo of what is really important. So why the shoe? We look at the different countries and so on where alleged terror attacks have happened, suicide bombers, alleged suicide bombers and so on. And for instance, in 2016, it's the same countries more or less now. We had Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nigeria, Syria, Somalia, India, the Philippines, Yemen, Thailand are the main ones. And then the rest of the world has about 10% of them. So let's have a look at different countries and see if we're able to find these shoes. So here we have the Westminster Bridge attack, where very, very bizarrely, you have like here to the right, this woman is trying to save this man after this alleged attack. And what have they done? She's giving him mouth to mouth and so on. But before that, she's made absolute sure to take off his shoe, put them very neatly on the pavement and right there for the photographer to get a shot of the shoes there. We have different victims. I'm just showing a few here because I've got hundreds and hundreds where victims are coming with one shoe off. That means that that person is taking part of this operation voluntarily, if it is one of these signs. Also, the shoes are left everywhere. We go continue here. It's not all of these photos I'm going to show to you are different attacks, different alleged suicide bombers, and so on, not from the same event. So here we have the London Bridge attack, which was not the same as the Westminster Bridge. What do we see? We find a shoe placed extremely central in one of the images. And these shoes, they just have to be there in a subtle way for us to be, for our subconscious to grab it and get it in there. Here we have the Manchester arena bombing, the alleged bombing there. Please, every time I say the name of a terror attack, add the word alleged before it. So here, the shoes, the shoes, the shoes. Here's one of the woman here. It said that she was hit by shrapnel from the bomb, and they show the shoe. We stand together, the shoes are there. People that come out from there, they come without the shoes. Why would you take your shoes off if you're trying to escape or you come out of an attack? Here we have the Westminster Bridge attack where a police officer is said to have been stabbed to death, where an MP is out there instead of the normal medical people here, the ambulance drivers and so on, doing CPR. This man, the MP, is doing CPR and later named a hero, once again, the hero. He was knighted by the Queen and so on. He was also in charge of when a lot of the English tourists was killed in Tunisia. He was also in charge of that whole operation. And here we have like their feet are almost like a religious old painting. The feet are the center of the image. So there was one guy that had tried to save his life. He does not appear on any photos, but he was invited to the TV studios next morning. And how did he come into the studio? He came without no shoes because he said he lost the shoes when he tried to save this police officer. I don't know how you lose your shoes doing that. And then, of course, when he was invited for the first time on national TV, I would suggest, were they the only shoes you had? Maybe you should put on some other ones, get some, buy some, take some sandals, at least socks. No, here he came bare feet into the studio and his bare feet was part of the conversation. I would suggest that these shoes and bare feet, both as being Freemasonic symbols, triggers, but it's also, I would say, possibly like a business card that they leave behind them when these are the operations. So in media in England, what was the images that was being spread on the newspapers? They were the shoes. You see how this strange blood underneath it, there's no blood coming from the body, but here we have this alleged victim. You can also see that these shoes have hardly been walked on. I believe that this was not a real body, but here you have the image, the shoe again, triggering. Madeleine McCann, this girl that was kidnapped and nobody really knows what happened to a very famous case in England and has spread all over the world. When that was lately reported in the news, what was the image used? The shoes. Then here, some latest thing, also when it comes to other events, like here is an alleged accident from an airplane show, an exhibition where it said that the plane crashed. What is the photo? Is it of the crashed plane? Is it of some cars that is said to turn on fire of the victims? No, a shoe. Here we have very recently there was two police officers stabbed in Greenock in England. What is the photo? The shoe. There's a whole wave of stabbings in the UK at the moment where the shoes are there every single time. The shoe. And then when Theresa May, the Prime Minister of England, when she celebrated Christmas, what did she put on top of a Christmas tree? A shoe. I mean, who does that? If it's not a message being sent out there, also for the people in the know, people that are involved in these operations, are this sort of like a secret communication system that every time they send out this message, people in the know around the world, they will see, okay, that's our operation, that's another one, that's another one. I have not been able to prove this, but I'm asking the question. So here, let's go to France. We got the Charlie Hebdo. What is outside the car of the terrorist? A shoe. When they run over, they're said to have shot this police officer. They run back, and the guy on the passenger seat, what does he do? He picks up the shoe, throws it in the car, and they take off, even though he has got two shoes on and the other shoe as well. So there was an additional shoe, and why did he even bother to pick it up? You got other terror events in France, the shoe. You got the riots afterwards. You got like almost an eyes wide shut individual in the black cape there at the bottom right. And right in front of it, a shoe. And then you got the Bataclan one, shoes again, left there. And more or less always Nike shoes. It's a repeated thing. Then you had the Bataclan massacre on November the 13th. 2015. And what is the symbol? You got like running blood on the wall and somebody has goose and put there. If I got back to the newspaper with photos like this and said, I want this photo, the editor would say, get out of here. No way. We want good photos. What the hell were you doing collecting those shoes? What is up with these shoes? So you had to ask yourself, how come that they have been published in mainstream media in these countries? Here we have Ireland, a recent shooting of the dad of a top level boxer. Then you have from many of the alleged bombings by IRA, the victims, what is there? The shoes. We go to Norway. What is the image that we are being shown from the mass shootings in Norway? Shoes. Italy. Here, it is one story. I believe that there are so many stories being spread in media, mainstream media at the moment, that are just not true. They're just there as part of the whole psyop into freaking us out, into believing this whole thing with a mass invasion of immigrants, all the violence, the crime rates going up. It's the same in all Western European countries, the same stories. And here it's said that in Italy, these people put a homeless guy on fire. So why? What would you take the photo of? The burnt body, the crime scene? No, shoes. And here, after the alleged riots, there was a big football game, Juventus. What happened there? The shoes. I also want to point out, when we talk about Italy, that at this very moment, the Bilderberg meeting 2018 is taking place in Turin. And every single year, just about a week or so before, there's been an alleged terror attack. I would suggest as a diversion for us to look the other way, look away from what is actually going on. Denmark. Here we have shoes lined up. This is not about the terrorism, but this is about people who have died because they cut down on so many different areas in the society. So why the shoes? And also, who can control the media in all of these countries? You have to ask yourself, what is going on here? The Belgium airport attack, the shoes. Afterwards, there was 9,000 shoes put out in a Brussels square, had nothing to do with each other, but the shoe is used once again. Benghazi, Libya, what are the photos we're being shown after this whole thing? The shoes. Who would bring like a rubber boot and just a shoe and put it right in the center of the image? You got the crime scene in the background. What is the photographer doing taking photos of shoes instead of being where he should be at the scene of whatever happened? Here, another one down to the right, another event, the shoes in the foreground. Spain, alleged terror attacks, different ones. What do we see? The shoes. The shoes, the shoes, the shoes. We go to Iraq. I mean, this is the home of the most terror attacks ever. What do we see? The shoes. And look at how they're positioned. It's not just a shoe. It is there to tell you something. It is there for a reason. And this lady's shoe to the left, if it was part of that, wouldn't there be blood spatter on top of it? Or is that one put afterwards? I would suggest when you look at it, it is put there afterwards. This is a staged crime scene. If it's real or not, I don't know, but that one is sending out a message. In Sweden, the alleged truck attack here, shoes, shoes, shoes. Then after, there was a second truck attack in Sweden that most people hadn't heard about. This truck was abandoned there. And when you look at the aerial footage of that truck, what is hanging on the telephone line on top of the truck? A pair of trainers. And here there were some alleged riots in Sweden a while ago with alleged Nazis and immigrants. And what do we see here? Once again, a pair of shoes in front of the ambulance. A normal professional photographer, if the shoes were standing there, he would kick them to the side and take a photo of the ambulance, not there. And you will see there's an additional shoe in front of the left front tire. What are they doing there? Here we have a girl, 11-year-old, that is said to have been killed at the truck attack in Stockholm. I heard there's some horrific images of a torn body, very, very horrific images of a torn body of a child after this event. But I've had doctors look at that, people that have been working at emergency wards for more than 20 years, and she told me that is not a real human body because there would have been a total bleed out. The body is totally massacred and more or less no blood whatsoever. So he said that is not a real body. And then the dad of this alleged victim, he's only done one interview, and in the interview, one of the first things that the interviewer says that, yeah, and on this day she was so happy because you had just given her a pair of shoes, didn't you? And he says, yeah. So the shoes, the shoes. Here, mass shooting at a nightclub, the Regina Club in Istanbul. What are the photos we're being shown? Shoes. Here's another alleged attack in Turkey. Shoe. Here, another one. Another one. They're not the same events. Please understand that. These come from different terror attacks. And here we have the Ankara Airport terror attack. Why on earth would you place a pair of trainers in the front of the image if they were not very important? It's taking up like one-fourth of the image, Nike trainers. Tunisia, the alleged terror attacks there. What are the photos that are being shared in international media? Shoes, shoes, shoes. And this was where this MP in England, he was in charge of that. Even in Iran, we have an alleged shooting of a politician here. And what is left on the crime scene? A shoe. Pakistan. I mean, is this getting boring for you? Because it's very repetitive. But then again, please see what is going on here. The alleged terror attacks, the alleged suicide bombers, the alleged all of these things. But as part of the operation, this is what we're being shown. And here we have an alleged mass shooting, which was an incredible shooting. It was in Peshawar at a school. You got a major shoe there as well. And at this shooting, it was very different from other shootings, because here on BBC and many other photos from the event, there were photos of Noah Postner, a young boy, 6 years old, that was said to have been killed in Sandy Hook 2 years earlier. And you can see it's the same photo. Even his father has been confronted with this, asking him, how could your son reappear and get killed yet again two years later, almost on the day, but this time in Peshawar, Pakistan? And when you look at the official crime photos, you have all of this horrific stuff, blood, blood, blood. And what is in the center of the image? Shoes. Yemen. How surprising. Shoes, 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 shoes. All of these alleged suicide attacks leaving shoes. Syria. Agony of victims. The shoes again. School bombings, suicide bombers. They show the shoes. Nike shoes once again. Here, they're also from a nursery. They said that they blew up a nursery. What do we see here? Bloodstains and shoes. And please notice that the color of the blood is extremely red, even though it's said to be hours and hours after these alleged events, that the blood is still this very, very powerful red, which is not normal. I mean, blood very quickly goes into a brown, rusty type of color, depending, of course, from where in the body it comes from and the amount of oxygen and so on. But it oxidizes very, very quickly. And here, more in Syria, also a photo propaganda thing about against Assad with the shoes right on top of this photo. Nepal, of all places, there was a cathedral bombing there. And so, of course, what images would you use? A shoe. Russia. Here's an alleged plane crash in Russia. So what do you take photos of? The plane, I would suggest, would be a good idea. No, the shoe. Somalia. Here we come. How surprising indeed. Here we go to Palestine, Israel. So here is a pizzeria blown up in Israel or Palestine. So what do we see? We see broken glass and a pair of shoes. We got more from Israel here. And when you look at these operations, I mean, the things that comes every single time when it comes to false flag terror, Mossad is there, CIA is there, working hand in hand, being in bed together, sometimes MI6, sometimes also using the intelligence agencies in whatever country they're carrying it out. And sometimes they use agencies from neighboring countries that will then carry out the operation, but will not be easily identified as would local agencies, because you never use the people from the same country, because they could be identified by coincidence and so on. So you always use from other countries. Here, also a Palestinian so-called terrorist is being arrested here. What have we got in the middle of the photo? The shoe. Shoes, shoes, shoes. So the Bali bombing 2002. What's there? The shoe. How come the FBI was there almost before the local police even came to the site? It was a massive, massive two explosions, the Sari Club and the Paddy Bar. I've recently been on location and checking it out. It's an incredible thing. The year after 9/11, getting Indonesia and Australia into the war of terror. And the memorial images and so on. What are we looking at? Shoes. Thailand. How surprising. We got shoes again. Look at the way they're placed. Is that what it looks like if a bomb has exploded or something like that? Would you place the shoes like that? And often it's not a pair of shoes, like somebody has been killed. There would be two shoes. But most of the time it's just one shoe. And here on the equipment, when the police comes to the site in Thailand checking out the bomb site, it says on the equipment, FBI. So I would ask, what is FBI doing in all of these countries? Because they are there, I tell you. I thought FBI was supposed to be in the US only. Not anymore. Kenya, Africa. And so terror attacks, suicide bombers, what are we looking at? Shoes. University shootings, supermarket shootings. Nigeria, here we come. Shoes. More shoes from Nigeria. Afghanistan, I mean, come on, you must be kidding me. More shoes of alleged terror attacks. Afghanistan is one country that has been hit very, very badly. But they use these images, like the top left one. That is not about a terrorist attack. It's about a murder of a local politician. But what do they take of the photos of the crime scene, of the body? No, not at all. They use the shoe again. It continues. Shoes. Even in Canada and the US and everywhere. Let me just show you also the Boston bombing. The symbol of the whole thing of the Boston bombing is the shoe. So let me quickly show you from the Charlottesville's alleged car attack. This is the car that is said to have just crashed into the crowd and it's leaving the site. And here, when the car leaves, what does it leave behind? A shoe. So who on earth have the power to coordinate all of these things? And also, recently, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the master of terror, if you ask me, he invited the Japanese PM for dinner. And what was the dessert? It was served in a shoe, which I would say is the ultimate insult. And here you got like Nike shoes, even with blood spatter on some of their models. And they've even used it in their marketing. You may not survive the blast, but your shoes will. I mean, somebody needs to ask Nike what is going on. And while looking for all of these images, I came across this image. And when I clicked on it, guess where it's linked? I click on it, and where did it take me? The CIA's own website, CIA.gov. And I would say this is where all the dots get connected. So with that said, I want to thank you for your patience. I'm sorry if I was very repetitive, but I think there is a very clear pattern going on here. And I think the more we see these patterns and we start understanding what's going on and also exposing the forces behind them, then we can stop so much mayhem in this beautiful, beautiful world that is meant to be a paradise and is now turned into absolute hell for a lot of people.
You've been listening to investigative journalist and author Ole Damgaard on Find the Clues and Connect the Dots. From the Deep Truth, Visionary Speak Out, online video conference produced by No Lies Radio. Next, we hear from author and radio host Kevin Barrett on Zionism, Psychopathy, and the Hijacked Provocation. Today's show, The Global Tour of Terror, A Theory of False Flag Operations. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So I'm going to be talking about the theory of false flag terror a little bit. It's hard to study the issue of false flags because obviously the people involved in them are unwilling to divulge most of the information about them. It's only on a fairly rare number of occasions that people who have been involved in false flags will say anything at all about them. People like Robert David Steele, who actually ran a false flag for the CIA, is not allowed to say anything other than that he did that and that nobody died, but he can't go into the details. It's all still classified. So we're studying a subject that is 99% underwater, like an iceberg. We only see the tip. And to try to figure out what's going on, we have to connect the dots and work with inadequate information and all kinds of clues, as well as the, you know, the hard facts that do get reported that end up ineluctably pointing towards the truth of these matters. So with that said, I'm going to say that the presentation I'm doing is on this new book by Laurent Guyonneau, From Yahweh to Zion. It's the culmination of his roughly decade study of false flags. And as a historian, I think that Laurent is in a very good position to study false flags, because journalists really have a hard time with false flags. They happen in real time. The journalists have to report in real time. And obviously, the people are not telling the truth about this. The information is not available for journalists. So it takes somebody like a historian who can piece together all of the evidence and the clues and ultimately often go back in time to see what has emerged about events in the past, who's more likely to be able to tell us how these things work, who actually is behind them, what they do precisely, what kinds of networks carry these out, how do they give orders to do things when this is all so top secret? Is there anything written? How does it get destroyed? All of this. So my presentation is focusing on three contributions that Laurent has made to the study of false flags. And these in the title, I'm listing Zionism, psychopathy, and the hijack provocation. We're going to start out with the last one, the hijack provocation, and work our way to the two earlier ones. So what is a hijack provocation? Well, before we get there, let's just introduce Laurent Guyonot. He is an engineer from the École Nationale Supérieure in Paris, and he earned his PhD a little later in medieval studies at the Sorbonne. He's written several books, some on medieval history, and his two most recent books take up the subject of false flags. JFK 9/11, published by Progressive Press a few years ago, and then From Yahweh to Zion, which I translated and published just a few months ago. In the book We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, which I edited a few years ago, Dr. Guyonot contributed a terrific chapter, which I think is really the one that gives us the theory of how these hijacked provocations work, how false flags sometimes are actually run as joint operations by more than one intelligence agency. And it may be that one intelligence agency is hijacking the operation from another one. And that seems to be what happened in the 2012 Mohamed Merah affair that Dr. Guyonot discusses in his contribution to We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. This event was essentially a two-part series of events, a little bit like Charlie Hebdo itself and many other of these events. Remember, in the Charlie Hebdo event, we had a bunch of cartoonists killed allegedly by angry Muslim radicals. And then we had a shooting and kidnapping, hostage-taking event at a kosher deli, tying together the attack on the nation and on free speech, that's the cartoonists, and then the attack on Jewish targets or Israel, which was the attack on the kosher deli. The same thing happened earlier in 2012 with the Mohamed Merah affair. He was the patsy who was blamed for these two totally separate and actually in reality probably essentially unconnected violent episodes. The first thing was on March 11th. These tattooed guys wearing neo-Nazi tattoos, presumably French soldiers, shot three North African French soldiers in Montauban, France. And various indicators suggest that this was, in fact, a DCRI false flag, that is a French intelligence false flag designed to demonize the National Front, the Front National, which is the supposed extreme right neo-Nazi party, in order to help Sarkozy, who was about to go down. That Sarkozy was in serious trouble in that election. The National Front was taking away the votes that he needed to win in the first round. And then suddenly there was this attack by apparent neo-Nazis, which demonized the National Front and actually helped Sarkozy survive in the first round. So that was the March 11th shooting. And then March 15th, another one, which helps make it even more of a publicity thing. And then on March 19th, there was a totally separate shooting at a Jewish religious school in La Roserie. Four people were said to have been killed, but there's no evidence actually that they were. That is, no autopsies were allowed, and the victims' bodies were allegedly immediately taken to a plane and flown to Israel to be buried as national heroes. But Laurent thinks that very likely there was actually no real shooting there. Then on March 21st, Mohamed Merah, who probably had nothing to do with either event, but who was a usual suspect, who was essentially a party-hardy guy. They told us he was a radical Muslim, but he wasn't. He was not religious in the least, and he was working for the intelligence services, and therefore they were able to manipulate him, and he was set up and executed in a dramatic night-long event. He was actually killed in the evening, and then they pretended that he was still alive and kept firing shots all night, and made up a false story about him leaping through a window and so on. So it was a huge television spectacular. So the hypothesis is, according to Laurent Guyonot, that the Israeli Mossad was able to seize upon this first series of shootings of the French soldiers, the Montauban affair, and then they created a fake shooting at the Jewish school and then claimed that the same guy did it. And this, of course, hijacks the whole thing to use for pro-Israel publicity, sending the message to the public that those who protest the war in Afghanistan and the coming war in Iran are killers of Jewish children. And then it also left French intelligence, the DSGI, vulnerable to blackmail because they had, of course, been involved in the Montauban operation. So now they're forced to go along with the Mossad agenda because the Mossad has the goods on them. So this is a hijacked provocation. That is a false flag started by one intelligence service and its assets and then hijacked by another one and perhaps actually magnified by another one. Could this explain any of the major false flags that we've seen? Well, Laurent Guyonneau says, yes, the two big ones, JFK and 9/11. This is Jack Ruby on the right, or Jacob Rubenstein, who was a hired killer for Mickey Cohen, the Jewish gangster who ran the West Coast for the Meyer-Lansky Syndicate at the time, and who on live television walked into the Dallas Police Department and killed Lee Harvey Oswald, the patsy or alleged lone assassin. According to Laurent Guyonneau, Gary Ween may be right. Now, how many JFK researchers have even heard of Gary Ween? Not a whole lot. But Ween actually may be barking up the right tree, according to Laurent Guyonneau, and suggesting that, in fact, he got this straight from Senator John Tower, that this JFK assassination was, in fact, what Tower called a double cross of fantastic dimensions, in which a fake assassination attempt staged by Howard Hunt and the CIA originally, and there's a lot of evidence to support this, that the first plans for the Dallas coup involved creating a fake assassination attempt against Kennedy to be blamed on the Cubans to trigger war in Cuba, which Kennedy had been leaning against, but this would have inflamed the country and forced a war on Cuba. So that's the CIA original attempt on Kennedy. It was supposed to be a fake assassination. And then, according to Gary Ween's information, as well as other information, what Ween calls the Russian Jewish Mafia, which is essentially Meyer Lansky's mob, which is essentially organized crime, the biggest organized crime syndicate in the world and in the United States at that time, moved in and took it over and actually killed the president. But, of course, behind this Mishpucha, or the so-called Russian Jewish mob, and Meyer Lansky, of course, we have the Israeli Mossad, David Ben-Gurion, who had just resigned in outrage over Kennedy's insistence that Israel would never get nuclear weapons. And, of course, the CIA Mossad infiltrator, James Jesus Angleton, was likely a major orchestrator of the Kennedy assassination as well. So, again, we have a possibility of a hijacked provocation with 9/11. As we had, according to Laurent Guyonneau, perhaps a U.S. deep state plan for a more limited false flag attack, perhaps just at the Pentagon, maybe plane crashes at the Twin Towers, who knows, but something that was aimed at justifying the invasion of Afghanistan. But this then may have been taken over by the infiltrated Zionist network, whose goal was much more ambitious. This was from Yahweh to Zion, and again, Laurent Guyonneau points out that the many players involved in 9/11 will essentially all have blackmail material on each other and be able to silence any who would otherwise get out of line. And that means that if indeed it were a more limited operation, in the same way that the JFK assassination may originally have been planned to be just a fake assassination attempt, here, if it were a more limited false flag that was suddenly turned into a massively murderous one with nearly 3,000 people dead, that those who had planned the more limited one would be in no position to expose the massively murderous one. And there's some evidence to suggest that Guyonneau could be right about this. According to Susan Lindauer, who worked for the CIA Iraq desk, she was handled by her case officer, Richard Fuse. They both knew, Richard Fuse learned and told Susan, that a huge terror attack was coming to Manhattan. Something big was coming to Manhattan anyway in late August, early September. And then on the morning of 9/11, Susan Lindauer was on the phone with her CIA case officer, Richard Fuse, and together they watched the Twin Towers burning and then suddenly exploding. And according to Susan Lindauer, Richard Fuse's reaction was this anguished scream, "The goddamn Israelis." This is one, you know, one piece of evidence that would go along with Lauren Guillenot's hijacked provocation hypothesis. That is that people in the CIA, like Fuse, knew something was planned. It was an inside job in that sense that the U.S. command chain was in on it, but that perhaps the murder of 3,000 people was a little more than they had realized was going to happen. There's all sorts of evidence that Israel was behind what happened at the Twin Towers. So another piece of evidence suggesting that 9/11 may have been this kind of hijack provocation is the testimony from people on board Air Force One that essentially they were targeted by somebody on the inside who had the code name for Air Force One, that was Angel, was threatening to shoot George W. Bush out of the skies after his plane took off from the elementary school in Florida. And so this means that there was a coup d'etat-style attack from one rogue network within the government against the rest of the government, as Webster Tarpley has pointed out in his work. And Bush, while on Air Force One, here he is on Air Force One on September 11th, he begged to return to Washington and take command, and Cheney refused the president's direct order, telling you who was actually acting president on September 11th. This, of course, was an act of treason by Cheney. Bush was sent to Barksdale Air Force Base and then finally to Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska against Bush's own wishes. Something happened to him there at Offutt Air Force Base. We don't know what. Then he was flown back to Washington, and that night he did his hostage video TV thing and said America is at war, read his lines that he was ordered to read. So there was obviously a coup d'etat by one faction of the government against other factions. And again, this goes along with Lauren Guillenot's hijacked provocation hypothesis. So more details about this hijacking of Air Force One and the threats against Air Force One came out just a couple of years ago on 9/11/2016 from NBC News, of all places, that Bush was furious and virtually unable to communicate with the outside world. So that is the coup plotters had essentially gotten control of the president. And perhaps Cheney was on board with some of those Israeli coup plotters. So an overview of hijack provocations includes, in all of these examples that we've seen, and there are a few others as well, we have a Western intelligence agency scheduling some kind of illegal operation, whether it's French intelligence shooting a couple of its own soldiers as a favor to Sarkozy to help him get elected, or it's the CIA setting up what's supposed to originally be a fake assassination attempt on Kennedy, or it's the CIA or Bush and the U.S. people setting up some kind of limited false flag on 9/11. Then it's hijacked and massively magnified, and especially in the latter two cases, by Israeli intelligence in collusion with their network of Sayonim, which, of course, are the 100,000-plus Jewish people around the world who are willing to volunteer for Mossad. Many of these people are in the very highest positions of power in countries all over the world. And then elements of organized crime, which is also largely dominated by people who are ethnically Jewish and who have a loyalty to the state of Israel. So the result is that the false flag is turned to serve Israel's interest. And those who know what happened, like Richard Fuse, the CIA case officer who knew something that was coming on 9/11, and then who realized what Israel did afterwards, have already been implicated, then they have to stay silent. And Richard Fuse also got, I think it was something like $10 million in hush money after 9/11, which he used to build a mansion near Washington, D.C., as Susan Lindauer has described. If you want a kind of a sketch of how this is done, check out John le Carré's book, The Little Drummer Girl. It's ostensibly a novel, but it's all based on information that John le Carré got from an inside Mossad source who describes precisely what the Mossad has been doing, how it runs rings around Western intelligence agencies in creating the theater of terror, that is false flag terror events. And another kind of hijacking is hijacking of truth movements. Lauren Guillenot argues that much of the 9/11 truth movement has knowingly or unknowingly been hijacked by Israel. The inside job phrase, he argues, is a catchphrase invented by Israel precisely to threaten the American government with massive destabilization if anybody in the American government ever tries to come forward with the truth about 9/11, which is that it was primarily an Israeli operation, then they're in a position to bring down the American house by having prepared this truth movement saying, inside job, inside job, inside job. It was the Americans that did it, the Americans that did it. Well, Guillenot argues that the major false flags in particular are disproportionately Zionist or Israeli. He points out that Israel has a long history and grand expertise in false flag terror, a world history of false flag operations. We need to dedicate at least half its pages to modern Israel, a nation less than half a century old. And I've listed some of the examples. Some of these false flags are admitted. The King David Hotel bombing, in which Mossad operatives or proto-Mossad operatives dressed up as Arabs blew up the King David Hotel. The Levant affair, in which Mossad operatives targeted Americans in Egypt and would have killed many Americans if, fortunately, things hadn't gone wrong for them. The Israeli government recently, not long ago, admitted that the Levant affair happened, that they did it, and then it gave honors and medals to the people who had planned to murder Americans in Egypt in a false flag attack. So how do we explain this Zionist preeminence in false flags? Lauren Guarino argues that this paranoid, they want to kill us mentality is inculcated by Jewish scripture, that every year Jews celebrate the plagues of Egypt, the killing of the firstborn Egyptians. The book of Esther celebrates the murder of, I think, 70,000 Persians who were supposedly plotting against the Jews. There's this paranoid notion. They want to get us. They want to kill us. They want another Holocaust. That excuses everything that we do. So that essentially takes away all restraints, moral scruples, and leads to extreme behavior. Then there's the extreme difficulty of fewer than 15 million Jews invading, occupying, and genocidally taking over the Holy Land of 4 billion Christians and Muslims. Naturally, bold measures would be required for such a nearly impossible project. And then there's the International Sayanim Network and the envy of all other intelligence agencies, hundreds of thousands of Jewish people around the world, many in the very highest positions, who are willing to volunteer free of charge to do anything for the Israeli Mossad. Then there's media dominance. Those who run the media decide which lies stand and which lies fall. And media in the Western world is heavily dominated by people who are ethnically Jewish with some degree of loyalty to Israel. They will never let out the truth about an Israeli false flag. They're inculcated to fear that terrible things will happen if they do. And finally, the domination of international organized crime and secret societies, banking and politics, again, by ethnically Jewish people, many, if not most of whom, have some degree of loyalty to the state of Israel. Finally, the psychopathy issue. Laurent Guyonneau, in his article, Israel, the Psychopathic Nation, takes up where Andrzej Lobosiewski left off in Political Ponerology, in which he argues whole nations can go psychopathic. Laurent argues that Israel has gone psychopathic in the same way that some communist countries did, according to Lobosiewski, perhaps Nazi Germany did, and so on. He argues that the Jewish nation as a state, but also as an organized world community, acts collectively towards other nations and other human communities in the way a psychopath acts towards his fellow men. Disclaimer, it goes without saying, he says, that I do not intend to imply that, quote unquote, the Jews are psychopaths, but instead that they are the first victims of a mental straitjacket imposed by their elites, who through the veritable intellectual terrorism make of them, to the extent that they comply, the instruments of the collective psychopathy of Israel. So this is collective psychopathy. It's not saying that individual Jewish people are psychopathic. Far from it. Israelis are always, and Zionists, and to some extent people who identify strongly tribally as Jewish, are always innocent victims. They see themselves as innocent, always innocent, no matter what they do. The other guy is always wrong. Everywhere we've gone, we've been persecuted and tormented and exterminated, and it's always been their fault. Well, this is exactly what psychopaths say. Martha Stout, one of the world's leading experts on psychopaths, says this is the first clue to a psychopath, is the other guy is always wrong. And then Israel's relationship to the United States, according to Guyonneau, is that of a typical psychopath who has influenced a powerful and impressionable man that he's going to use to accomplish his misdeeds. And Laurent compares this to Colonel House, the Zionist manipulator of President Wilson, who dragged the United States into World War I. Not all Zionist leaders are even willing members of this kind of psychopathic group contagion. Moshe Sharet was a very honorable, noble, and ethical Israeli leader. He was the foreign minister from 1948 to 1956, and then the prime minister, who was horrified by the methods of Ben-Gurion and other more mainstream Zionists who were dedicated to set the Middle East on fire and frighten the West into supporting Israel's aims by, quote, raising terrorism to the level of a sacred principle. That is precisely what Israel has done, and certainly never so much so as since 9/11. So why are people like Charette and other ethical Israeli leaders, and there have been some, why can't they overcome the psychopathic ideological power machine of Zionism? And finally, this is Laurent Guillenot's argument that he makes in From Yahweh to Zion, that this is rooted in the Bible. He says, in the final analysis, does not the Zionist manipulation go back to the creation by these ancient priests, the Levites, of a tribal god by the name of Yahweh, who has usurped the title of the creator of the universe and father of humanity? Ultimately, is not Zionism the logical outcome of Yahwism? And then he writes in this article, this is a question I will reserve for another article. Well, in fact, that article turned into a very, well, a moderately long book, 500 some pages, From Yahweh to Zion, which again, I translated from French and published a couple of months ago, earlier this year. So if you want to follow up on this and entertain this very provocative and, of course, controversial argument, I highly recommend reading From Yahweh to Zion. It got a very favorable, somewhat, including a disclaimer, but a very favorable review from John Cobb, who is probably the world's greatest liberal Christian theologian. And it's also gotten rave reviews from people like Gilad Atzman and others that you would expect to appreciate this material. It's a very fair-minded attempt to look at the so-called Jewish question throughout history and find out to what extent these issues are rooted in kind of a culture. It's not racist. It's not about biology. It's all about culture. And we are in a position where we do have to analyze cultural influences on political behavior if we want to understand what's really going on, and especially what's been really going on in the world since September 11th, 2001.
You've been listening to author and radio host Kevin Barrett on Zionism, Psychopathy, and the Hijacked Provocation. Today's show has been The Global Tour of Terror, A Theory of False Flag Operations. Kevin Barrett is an author, editor, and radio host of Truth Jihad Radio and False Flag Weekly News. Visit truthjihad.com and noliesradio.org. For more information on Oli Damagard's investigations of assassinations and false flag operations, visit lightonconspiracies.com. That's lightonconspiracies.com. To view the archived live stream of the Deep Truth Visionaries Speak Out online video conference, visit noliesradio.org. That's noliesradio.org. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yoram Mafo, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at G&B Radio.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G, and our new world order. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, journalist, essayist, and activist Chris Hedges speaks ad lib, and speaks very well indeed. I hope you'll stay tuned. Chris Hedges speaks ad lib on New World Notes today. I've been producing this show for 8 years. When I began, Chris Hedges barely registered on my radar. Other voices from the left were louder and clearer. That was then. Now, 8 years later, Noam Chomsky is still out there, actively fighting the good fight. Michael Parenti has been speaking less than he had been, though. Both of these men are now in their 80s. And since the show began, Howard Zinn has died. George Carlin has died. Gore Vidal has died. Too many fine, radical voices have been stilled. Just last night, I was reading a book of Gore Vidal's essays. The essay I was reading began by reminding us that the word radical comes from the Latin for root. A person who tries to get at the root of a problem is called a radical, often sneeringly by established power. Established power doesn't want the roots of society's problems exposed, because established power is profiting nicely from those problems. That's why our nation's phony political debates are so depressing and irrelevant. Because nobody is permitted to dig anywhere near the root of our problems. Not with all our mass media and both political parties owned and operated by the U.S. corporate oligarchy. That's not me speaking, incidentally. Gore Vidal wrote all that back in 1992. Sharp guy. Every major American institution now serves corporate power. That's why the radical imagination and radical voices are so important today, and so hard to find. That's why it was such a bummer to lose George Carlin and Howard Zinn and Gore Vidal. Who will take their place? Then, pretty much out of the blue, comes Chris Hedges. Or so it seemed to me. He's got the attitude we need, and the critical habits of mind, and the moral compass, and formal education, too. B.A. from Colgate, Master's from Harvard Divinity School. Then, 15 years' experience as a foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Spent a lot of time in war zones. A few weeks ago, New World Notes played Hedges' recent speech in Seattle called The Algebra of Revolution. That was a fine talk. If you missed it, feel free to go to our website and download a free copy. That's newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Like Michael Parenti and Noam Chomsky, Hedges is often very good at speaking impromptu, without a script. In the question and answer session that followed his Seattle talk, Hedges did just that. We'll hear some of that now. In the first part of today's program, Hedges speaks about the corruption of our judicial system, the perfidy of the banks, the irrationality of the bank bailout beginning 2008. He explores whether Obama had good intentions and failed to deliver, or was he just jiving us all along? Hedges also speaks of the propaganda from our corporate-controlled media and of the bad effects of uncontrolled corporate power. Here is Chris Hedges.
We had some really good news out of Spokane, Washington this week, where a judge ruled that three individuals that had been tortured by the U.S. government had the right to sue the government. I'm wondering if you're seeing other points of light in the legal system that you could shed some light on for us tonight.
Well, there are points of light, including there are judges that ruled after the Snowden revelations that, as Al Gore said, this was a crime against the Constitution. But the superstructure itself shuts down those individuals of conscience. I mean, there is no way to justify giving the U.S. Constitution the surrender of our privacy. It cannot be done legally. There is no way to justify under our Constitution the use of the military as a domestic police force. There is no way, I think, to justify the absurd idea that corporations are human beings and have a right to drop dark money into our elections. So I think the court system, while you can get singular individuals, the weight of the institution nullifies what they've done. I mean, the issue of privacy, I think I found that the inability of our system to respond to give us back our privacy, I found quite frightening.
I wanted to address the financial terrorism from the banks. As we know, after the bailout, 8 years later, they're still rampant with fraudulent deeds. Iceland broke up the banks.
Right. Well, they put bankers in jail.
Put them in jail, because I think if we just fine them, it's another tax write-off.
Right.
So I think we have to hold them accountable and jail them.
Well, they never get fined. I mean, Goldman Sachs just paid $5 billion, which is nothing for Goldman Sachs. And actually, you know, that's kind of, if you look at the fine print, they're not never going to pay $5 billion. But nobody's held accountable. I mean, Lloyd Blankfein should be in prison. Most of my students should be out of prison.
So it's like, would you break up the banks and do state banks?
Yeah, I'm with Ralph Nader. We need to nationalize the banking system. Yeah.
Thank you.
Along with public transportation, along with the utilities, private companies have no right owning water or electricity. Yeah, and you know, at the bailout in 2008, Nader said, why are we giving trillions of dollars to Citibank? Why aren't we creating public banks with our money? And why aren't these public banks renegotiating these fraudulent mortgages so that people are not forced out of their homes? This is a rational response. You know, the bailout bill of 2008 had no public support. Constituent calls were 100-1 against the bailout. It doesn't matter. When we sued Obama under the NDAA, they did a national poll. It had a 97% disapproval rating. But it passed anyway. Nobody wants the TPP, or these. We've seen what NAFTA does, and the TPP is NAFTA on steroids. We get it. We get trade agreements. We know what they're about. And there's an extremely good chance that as soon as these elections are over in November, these people are going to go in and pass it.
Do you think Obama ever had good intentions when he was campaigning, or do you think he knew all the bad things he's going to do when he got in?
Well, the difference between Barack Obama and George W. Bush is that George W. Bush was as stupid as he looks and clueless. And Obama, I think, was cynical. Obama is smart. He knew damn well what he was doing. He was only 2 years in the Senate. But Kucinich gave me his voting record. He said, you better read it, because it is one corporate giveaway after another. In that sense, I don't care what they say. I mean, they spend a lot of money on public relations. I care how they vote. And one of the problems with Sanders is that, yes, he voted against the war in Iraq, but he subsequently voted for the military appropriations to keep these wars going and the money for national security. So I think Obama played us. And I think if you look at Susskind's book, or where there's kind of reporting behind the veil, that I mean, remember, he's a product of the Chicago political machine, which is one of the dirtiest machines in the country. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I also ran a lobby organization in the 80s when Reagan was doing the Iran-Contra affair, Hanford, START Treaty, and we were very successful. We got what we wanted. And, you know, we had 60,000 members behind us, and I sent people week to week to week after that. But I don't even think that we can do that anymore. I really don't think that the people's voices can be heard anymore if I even set up a lobby organization to send individuals to Congress.
Right. Well, look, you make a good point, because, and this gets into the destruction of our media. Clinton, which did a lot of damage to working men and women in this country, deregulated the FCC. So we allowed roughly a half dozen corporations to buy up the airwaves, Viacom, Comcast, General Electric, Murdoch's News Corp. And at the same time, public radio and public television was destroyed and became dependent on corporate money or grant money, which is Democratic or corporate money. So that on the 10th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, on Morning Edition, who are they interviewing? Wolfowitz. Reverentially. So what have we learned, you know? And so as people resist, we saw this with the Iraq War. Hundreds of thousands of people marching San Francisco, not covered, totally blocked out. And so that is a difference. In the 60s, CBS, and they would all have the cameras down in Birmingham. And it's all become about ratings. I mean, it's much more pernicious than the old newspaper empires, like the Hearst Empire, which were bad enough. He kind of gave us Spanish-American War and the advent of American imperialism overseas. But now it's a giant corporation where news is just one of perhaps hundreds of revenue streams, and they compete against those other revenue streams. So it's all about advertising or ratings. And there's been an utter destruction, especially on the commercial media, of the news industry. So you're right. You raise a good point. It is much harder for the voice, the unapproved or unsanctioned voices of the citizenry to be heard. And that's dangerous, because the more they shut us down, I mean, you look at the Occupy movement, so you have this relatively benign, they weren't quite as revolutionary as they thought, movement that asks for very rational things, jobs, universal health care, and the state eradicates them physically. Now, a rational response would have been a jobs program, would have been health care, would have been a moratorium on student debt. All that would have been rational. But because corporate power is now unfettered and uncontrolled, And because they don't, as a writer in the New Yorker said, they don't live in America, they live in Richistan. They're not sitting next to you on the economy seat in Delta. They don't have any clue. And when societies disintegrate, and you can look at the Forbidden City, Versailles, they retreat into these worlds that are utterly unplugged from what's happening around them, and yet they have total power. And so they're making decisions without understanding the consequences. And that's where we are, and that's why it's dangerous. Because they have no conception. I mean, you see it, how knocked off balance they have been by this political campaign. You see it on the TV with the chattering, all the courtiers posing as television journalists. So you're right. It's harder. You're right.
But what do we do, though?
I mean, we have to get out there and just keep fighting anyway. Yeah.
So keep going. Yeah.
Yeah.
On New World Notes, you're listening to Chris Hedges, speaking impromptu in April 2016. Hedges now discusses some familiar themes: how the Democratic Party betrayed its voters and sold out to corporate interests, how the system is incapable of internal reform, and how the only viable response we can make to this is nonviolent rebellion. Back to Chris Hedges.
Well, it wasn't quite extortion. What happened, it really rose with Clinton's understanding that if he did corporate bidding, he got corporate money. So that's how you got NAFTA. That's how you got the destruction of the welfare system. Originally, under our old welfare system, 70% of those recipients were children. That's how you get the Omnibus Crime Bill of 1994 that explodes the prison population. That's how you get the destruction of Glass-Steagall, the FCC. And by the 90s, the Democratic Party had fundraising parity with the Republicans, and when Obama ran in 2008, he got more. So basically what you had was a Democratic establishment that did have at one point a liberal wing that decided to sell itself out completely. And that's why Nader ran for president, because I think 24 pieces of major health, safety, and environmental legislation were written by Ralph Nader, but pushed through the Congress by that liberal wing of the Democratic Party that no longer exists. And that, unfortunately, now has become the system that governs. So it's, you know, it's one bird of prey with two wings.
Can we get this done without a French-like revolution?
I don't think that we can work with corporate power. I think corporate power must be destroyed or overthrown. I'll repeat that for the Homeland Security person. That's overthrown. No, I think we've reached a point where the system is incapable of internal reform. And I obviously want to see a revolutionary movement that's nonviolent. And I watched it in Eastern Europe. I mean, in the Stasi state of East Germany, which was the most efficient police state until our own. And there, it followed the classic pattern of revolutions whereby, as the demonstrations grew in Leipzig, Erich Honecker, who had been the communist dictator for 19 years, sent down an elite paratroop division to Leipzig to shoot the crowd. And when the paratroopers got to Leipzig, the Communist Party officials in Leipzig forbade them to deploy in the streets. And Honecker was out within a week. These regimes that are this decayed, as ours is, can crumble very quickly. Once those who are tasked with employing the brute mechanisms of control will no longer do so. That's how the Russian Revolution was a non-violent, yes, there was anarchist violence and Alexander II was assassinated, but it fundamentally fell through non-violence. When the Petrograd bread riots happened, the Cossacks were sent in and they refused to fire on the crowd. So the Tsar is up on the front. They shove him in the imperial rail carriage. He abdicates on a railway siding. He didn't even make it back. That is true in every revolution. So once the system is discredited, we had 500,000 people in Alexanderplatz in East Germany, 500,000 people in Wenceslas Square in Prague, and that discredited elite. And it doesn't matter how many weapons they have. The Shah of Iran had the fourth largest military in the world at the time. But once he fled, the armed forces issued a statement that they would not protect the regime. That is how revolutions happen. It gets into the Bolshevik Revolution, which, as Adam Ullmann, the great scholar of the revolution, says was in fact a counter-revolution. The destruction of decentralized power, the Soviets, Lenin and the Bolsheviks create a paramilitary faction with the Red Guards. They go in October and violently take control and then impose a form of state capitalism. And revolutions are always susceptible to counter-revolutions. This is what happened in Romania in particular, which I also covered, where Ceausescu was overthrown. You had a few days where workers took over the factories and then the Securitate showed up again. But we have more power than we, I think. And once we begin to exercise that power, it becomes apparent. You can see it on video, probably on YouTube. But Ceausescu would hold his annual meetings when they'd bus all the workers into the square. And it's an amazing moment in history. And he's up on the balcony with his wife, Elena. And eventually the crowd just starts booing and hissing. Was unthinkable in Romania. And you watch him in a panic, and you watch him in the microphone suddenly start offering reforms. And then he's helicoptered out. And we have that power if we use it. And it's time to use it.
So far, Chris Hedges has stayed on familiar ground. But then he addresses a subject I've never heard him talk about before. Someone asks him a question about the attempts by some pressure groups to brand all criticism of Israel as anti-Semitism. In fact, the California legislature did just that in 2012 with its notorious House Resolution 35. Hedges replies with a clear and forceful condemnation of the government of Israel, of AIPAC and similar pressure groups, and of all attacks on freedom of speech. He speaks in favor of the BDS movement, calling for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel until that country's government ends its half-century-long military occupation and blockade against Palestine. I've never heard Hedges speak on the subject before, and here he's not pulling any punches.
Recently, the state of California passed Resolution 35. Are you familiar with it?
Which is it?
Resolution 35.
Right, but
what
is it?
Which stated that you cannot say anything negative against the state of Israel.
Oh, right. Yeah,
and especially in the academic world.
Right.
How could they possibly have passed that resolution when we do have the right to freedom of speech?
Well, we have the right of freedom of speech as long as it is set within the parameters they give us, which, as Dorothy Parker once said about Katharine Hepburn's emotional range as an actress, runs from A to B. And if you step outside those parameters, you have no voice. So what is the debate about Syria? Should we bomb them, or should we bomb them and put boots on the ground? As if those are the two options. Well, I'm a strong supporter of the BDS movement. Israel is terrified because it's taken off in Europe. Sander doesn't like me too much, and one of the reasons he doesn't like me is because right after he and every other senator voted for that AIPAC resolution when they were bombing Gaza about Israel's right to defend itself, he and I spoke in Wisconsin, and as soon as he finished, I got up and spoke about Palestine and called him and every other senator an AIPAC wind-up doll. I mean, are you really, it's like the old Soviet Union. Are you telling me there isn't one senator who opposes the saturation bombing of a people that do not have an air force, mechanized units, artillery, a navy? That's not a war. It's murder. And the Israeli government has used the mechanism that powerful entities, the gun lobby, corporations use, and that's money. They bought these people off. And if you challenge them, they will use their considerable resources to destroy you. But it's interesting, I speak to students for Justice Palestine at all sorts of universities, and invariably when I meet with them, half of them are Jewish. You know, young Jewish men and women with a conscience. And that scares Israel tremendously, and they have every right to be scared. So what they're doing is banning these movements, Northeastern, other Florida State, others. It follows a very familiar pattern where not only are the movements banned, but all of the students who are in that movement are stripped of their positions of leadership in the university. So when I was at Northeastern, I was there a week after they banned it, for putting up mock eviction notices to draw attention of the seizure of Palestinian homes by Israelis. There was a student in that group who was president of the student council. He was stripped of his position. It's nothing to do with Israel. They remove, and then they put them all on probation. But ultimately, that's going to be very counterproductive for Israel, I think. The fact that they have overreacted to BDS to such an extent shows how frightened they are. And I just spoke to about 300 BDS activists in Washington. All of my energy goes into movement. I will vote third party unless the Green Party doesn't make it on the ballot in New Jersey. Then I'll write in Edward Snowden. I'm not going to play their game. I'm not going to play their game. And the sooner large numbers of us step out and stop playing their game, the more trouble they're going to be in. Thank you.
You've been listening to Chris Hedges, Ad Lib, speaking in Seattle last April 2016. Thanks to Pirate Radio Seattle for the video recording. I have edited the audio for radio broadcast. Speaking of audio, you can find recordings of all of our shows on the web. We're at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening to New World Notes, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, reminding you that an injury to one is an injury to all, and hoping you'll come back again next week. We started this show lamenting some radical voices we had lost. Why don't we end up with one that we still have? David Rovics.
It can happen in a moment. Sometimes it does when what could be is and what shouldn't be was. There are times when you gotta stand steady. There are other times when you gotta be ready. The window can open, seems so wide, but you can never tell when it's gonna slam shut. One day you're a target on the firing ranges. The next day all of a sudden, everything changes. Crashing down when it all
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm joined in the studio by Frank Tolupko. Frank Tolupko is a 9/11 researcher and is on hiatus from doing a radio program on 9/11 in Great Barrington, Mass. Frank, welcome to the show.
Good to be back again.
Today, Frank and I are going to talk about the left-leaning Democrats' selective amnesia and hypocrisy, and that anybody in national politics is beholden to the deep state. And by and large, policies don't really change from one administration to the next. And our first example of this is with immigration. Many on the left are critical of Trump's immigration policy, which, if you care to look at it, appears to be an extension of Obama's immigration policies and infrastructure. But many on the left refuse to acknowledge this and did not say a peep when Obama was deporting millions. Here's Ben Swan on Reality Check TV making this point.
Well, we have shown you the tens of thousands of people protesting in the streets over the election of Donald Trump. They say a major reason for their protests, Trump claims that he will deport at least 2 to 3 million illegal immigrants. So if that is truly important to them, why have none of these people protested that President Obama has actually deported more than 3 million people since taking office? This is a reality check you won't see anywhere else. Yeah, the protests have been loud and they've gotten a lot of media attention. The claim is that President-elect Donald Trump will unfairly deport millions of undocumented immigrants. So before we look at the hypocrisy here, let's listen to what Donald Trump has actually said.
What we are going to do is get the people that are criminal and have criminal records, gang members, drug dealers. We have a lot of these people, probably 2 million. It could even be 3 million. We're getting them out of our country or we're going to incarcerate.
All right, so Donald Trump wants to deport 2 to 3 million undocumented immigrants with criminal backgrounds. And into the streets, protesters flow. Okay, but where have those protesters been over the past 8 years? Because according to the Pew Research data analysis that was released in August, get this, the Obama administration has deported an unprecedented 2.4 million illegal immigrants between 2009, when he took office, and 2014. That was the last year data was available. So with 2 years left on his term, Obama had already deported well above Trump's minimum estimate of 2 million undocumented immigrants. Now, let's go a little further on this, because if you take the numbers from 2014 alone, it's over 414,000 immigrants who were deported. It's not even his highest year. But if we assume that 2015 and 2016 will match 2014's number, then we can reasonably estimate that over the course of his term, President Obama will have deported at least 3.2 million people by the end of this year. So how many people is that? Well, according to governmental data, the Obama administration has deported more people than any other president's administration in history. In fact, they have deported more than the sum of all the presidents of the 20th century. So just let that sink in for a minute. More deportations than all the presidents of the 20th century combined. What you need to know is that the hypocrisy here is almost infuriating. If you are against Donald Trump's plans to deport up to 3 million immigrants, okay, you have every right, and you probably should protest. But if you are infuriated that Donald J. Trump wants to do it, and yet you were silent as Barack Obama actually did it, are you really interested in solving the problem? Or are you just opportunistically outraged?
so, Frank. I think Ben Swan did a pretty good job of discussing that. Did you have any comments you wanted?
Many conversations I've had with my friends who generally are, not generally, I think adamantly opposed to what Trump is doing vis-a-vis people that are here that are undocumented, refuse to really consider what Obama did with this specific policy. Interesting, before Obama was elected a year or two, I went to a lecture by Zbigniew Brzezinski, an advisor to various campaigns and presidents, both Republican and Democratic, and he actually said publicly, I have it on tape, that what we needed in the next election cycle, and this was during the Bush administration as it was coming to an end, was an African-American president, because then we can do all these things and get away with certain policies. He didn't use the word get away with, but he said, you know, like put in policies that might be somewhat unpopular, but with a popular president, they could get away with it.
Yeah, and you know, I have some friends who are Democrats, and when I try to tell them that Obama deported more people than anyone in the whole 20th century, any president, they never heard about it. They don't even know about it. So the media is making a big deal out of it when Trump does it, but they didn't say anything when Obama was doing it, or very
little. Then I guess if they didn't hear about it, then it's not amnesia or whatever. They just weren't informed about it.
So either they weren't informed about it, or they didn't want to admit that they knew about it. And now we're going to hear another clip making this same point. This one is from the Al Jazeera English station, and the show is called, again, Reality Check, and the host is Mehdi Hasan. So here it is.
One of the many, many criticisms of Donald Trump centers on his pledge to deport, to forcibly relocate all 11 million undocumented immigrants in the U.S. in his first 2 years in office. But remember, this is how he defended that odious policy in the second presidential debate.
Nobody knows about it. Nobody talks about it. But under Obama, millions of people have been moved out of this country. They've been deported.
Now, annoyingly, he's got a point. Kind of. The truth is that the Obama administration has deported 2.5 million undocumented immigrants from the United States over two terms. 2.5 million. That's the highest number for any president ever. In fact, Obama is on course to have deported more people in his 8 years in office than all of the presidents of the 20th century combined. I guess that explains why his immigration enforcement budget in 2015 was a whopping $18 billion. That's $3 billion more than the budgets of all the other major domestic law enforcement agencies combined. Now, the Obama administration says the vast majority of the people it deports are people with criminal records, felons, threats to national security, which sounds reasonable, except that a study in 2014 found that two-thirds of deportation cases involved people who had committed minor infractions, including traffic violations, or had no criminal record at all. Take the case of Jose Marvin Martinez, who fled Honduras aged 16 after his brother was murdered by suspected gang members. In 2014, he was deported back to his home country, and just 4 months later, he was shot to death by suspected gang members. Or how about Giovanni Miranda, who arrived in the United States as a child and was working legally when he had a minor traffic accident in 2009, when immigration officers discovered he'd been charged with a minor drug possession offense 7 years earlier. They sent him back to El Salvador, a homeland he'd never known. 3 years after his return, he was murdered by a gang in front of his wife and newborn child. These are just two out of tens of thousands of real-life stories, real-world tragedies, that many say will forever taint Obama's record on human rights and especially on immigration. So complain as much as you like about Trump's grotesque deportation plans, but the fact is that he's inheriting the most sophisticated and well-funded human expulsion machine in the history of the country from his Democratic predecessor. And shed as many tears as you like for outgoing President Barack Obama, but never forget that until Donald Trump came along, he was the deporter-in-chief.
So the question now is, where were all of you Obama supporters and Hillary supporters when Obama was deporting millions? Why were you silent then? And why are you only speaking out now when Trump is doing the same thing? So, Frank, what's your next example of amnesia and hypocrisy?
Next up is Hillary Rodham Clinton, who, as Secretary of State in the Obama administration, was deeply involved with the events in Libya and the takedown of Muammar Gaddafi. She was scheduled for an interview with CBS Television on October 20th, 2011, right around the time things were going south in Libya at that point. She was evidently informed before the interview began that Gaddafi had been killed or assassinated or whatever. And this is her reaction, which was never really put on the air, but was captured in banter before the interview.
So here she is, Hillary Clinton, talking about the death of Muammar Gaddafi.
We came, we saw, he died.
Many people still believe that if Hillary had been elected instead of Donald Trump, we would have had a much more rational domestic as well as foreign policy. But as you heard from her reaction to it, I don't think she'd had a very serious approach to foreign policy and bantering about the assassination of a leader of a country in Northern Africa. What I think is belied here is the fact that the reasons that we went in, and don't forget that she was Secretary of State and deeply involved in the decision to go into Libya, I think the reasons for going into Libya are much more than what we were fed in the press of, oh, we're taking out somebody that's cruel, a cruel dictator, etc. So why don't we listen to Gary Franke from the Patreon.com website, the Next News Network, where he's discussing at that point, which was back April 2nd, 2011, Hillary Clinton's advisor, Sid Blumenthal, sent Hillary an email, a rather frantic email, of why we should go and take out Muammar Gaddafi. These emails came from the release by Edward Snowden's WikiLeaks.
Okay, so here's that clip with Gary Franke.
Check this out. Now, some have spoken about this, but now Clinton emails have revealed the actual reason that she ousted Gaddafi. And, yes, these emails expose Hillary Clinton's true masters. Absolutely insane when these emails hit. My friends, Sputnik News is reporting that a declassified email exchange between the former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and her advisor Sid Blumenthal shows that Clinton was up to her eyeballs in the Western conspiracy against Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi and his Pan-African gold dinar currency. That's according to William Engdahl, who's made these statements after reviewing these emails. It states here that a recently declassified email from the illegal private server used by the ex-Secretary of State and Democratic presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton during the Washington-orchestrated war against Muammar Gaddafi sheds some new light on the U.S. establishment's genuine motivation. Quote, in a newly classified Clinton email from Sid Blumenthal to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton dated April 2nd, 2011, Blumenthal reveals the reason that Gaddafi must be eliminated. Engdahl made this article, he revealed it in a magazine, New Eastern Outlook, quote, using the pretext of citing an unidentified high source, Blumenthal writes to Clinton, according to sensitive information available to this source, Gaddafi's government holds 143 tons of gold and a similar amount in silver. This gold was accumulated prior to the current rebellion and was intended to be used to establish a Pan-African currency based on the Libyan golden dinar, he writes. Quote, by 2008, the prospect of sovereign control by a growing number of African and Arab oil states of their state and oil gas revenues was causing serious concern in Wall Street as well as the city of London. It was huge liquidity in the trillions. They potentially no longer would be able to control it. Meanwhile, in 2009, Gaddafi, then president of the African Union, offered the states of the continent to shift to a new currency independent from the U.S. dollar, the so-called gold dinar. And the rest is history. See, Gaddafi was getting ready to challenge the central banking monopoly of the planet, the Federal Reserve, the banksters. And what did they do? They took him out. See, he did not want to be linked to New York. He did not want to be linked to London. He wanted to have currency independence from U.S. control. That's what he wanted. He wanted to be free from that. You know, if you look back, I mean, how long was Gaddafi, you know, holding down Al-Qaeda? And he was, I mean, we had some pretty reasonable relationships as far as I can tell. And then all of a sudden, he's about to launch a gold dinar, challenge the banksters. And like that, Hillary Clinton arms the rebels. They take him out. Christopher Stevens ends up being one of the casualties of the American side. And then what happens next? ISIS takes control of Libya. And then you've got arms being dumped into Syria. The complete destabilization even further of the Middle East. All because, at least for Libya's sake, the gold dinar about to be launched. See, if Africa was able to stand on its own with its own gold currency, they'd be able to prosper. They would be able to keep their money inside their local country. And that's really where all the power is. It's local. It's not when you submit to these central bankers. That's why local currencies are so powerful. And there's a lot of them out there. Anyway, amazing revelation coming out of that server that Hillary Clinton has.
Well, so as they say, follow the money.
Yeah. Under Gaddafi, Libya became probably the most prosperous, I don't say probably, the most prosperous country in all of Africa, the whole entire African continent. They had the highest standard of living, and that's including the Union of South Africa, best health care, and all their numbers in terms of health figures were fantastic, mm-hmm. education, etc. But he wanted to step online and go in their independent way, and that just didn't go with the big boys down on Wall Street or whatever. I remember pictures of Gaddafi meeting with George Bush after 9/11 saying, I've got some Al-Qaeda guys, you want them? And the State Department says, no, we don't. So he was actually trying to cooperate in all ways possible and trying to be an equal partner economically with North America and him being one of the leaders of the African continent.
Yeah. And, you know, Iran recently decided to go off the dollar also in purchasing from foreign countries. And so just watch what happens there. You can already see the step up in the aggression towards Iran.
Well, going even back to the George Bush days, where he gave that speech to Congress about the axis of evil, that included North Korea, that included Iran, and Libya, because why? They were all talking about going off the petrodollar.
Yeah, so again, follow the money. And now we're going to talk about two more Democratic icons, Madeleine Albright and Bill Richardson.
Yes, taking a little trip down memory lane, or is it unmemory lane? We're talking about Madeleine Albright, who just came out with a new book called Fascism, A Warning, talking about the evils of the Bush administration, and many, I'm sure much of the stuff in there is correct. But she has some stuff to answer for as Secretary of State in Bill Clinton's administration and her views about what the effects of the sanctions that were placed on Iraq, supposedly because they had weapons of mass destruction, under the Clinton administration. What we did there was essentially, according to the UN reports, etc., over 500,000 children perished because we bombed water treatment plants, we drove to sewage treatment plants, etc. And it was a horrific event in the history of that country or in the world. And Ms. Albright was asked about this on TV and what she felt about in the aftermath with the ability of hindsight, what she thought about those particular events.
And here she is, Madeleine Albright.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
Those were Madeleine Albright's comments in 1996, being interviewed by Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes, the CBS TV show. She was then ambassador to the UN at that point. And you can see the heartless her response to over 500,000 kids dying. She, after the fact, a number of years later, deeply apologized for it. But what she apologized for was that she never should have said it. That she never said that she was wrong or that was a bad analysis of what was going on. She just said that it just slipped out or whatever, and she was deeply apologetic. So we have to take her honesty with a grain of salt there. I guess we can go now to another icon, Bill Richardson, who was a presidential hopeful at one time. He was a New Mexico governor. He spoke Spanish. He was supposedly good on immigration, etc., and he was being touted as perhaps a presidential hopeful. He was interviewed on Democracy Now! In September of 2005. He was Clinton's ambassador to the UN while all this stuff was going on in Iraq. So let's see what he has to say about those events.
We are joined right now in the Capitol building where we're broadcasting from by the New Mexico governor, Bill Richardson. He is a 7-term Congress member, served in the House of Representatives for 7 terms. He was the energy secretary under Bill Clinton, as well as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, now governor of New Mexico. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. But many say that although President Bush led this invasion, that President Clinton laid the groundwork with the sanctions and with the previous bombing of Iraq. You were President Clinton's U.S. Right. ambassador to the United Nations.
The sanctions were the correct policy.
Right. The U.N. sanctions, for example, the sanctions led to the deaths of more than 500,000 children, not to mention more than a million Iraqis.
I stand behind the sanctions. I believe that they successfully contained Saddam Hussein. I believe that the sanctions were an instrument of our policy.
To ask a question that was asked of U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Madeleine Albright, do you think the price was worth it, 500,000 children dead?
Well, I believe our policy was correct, yes.
So these statements by Hillary Clinton laughing at killing of Gaddafi and then Madeleine Albright saying that it's okay to kill 500,000 children.
Because it served U.S. policy and interests.
And then Bill Richardson all agreeing with that is really astounding to me. And as you pointed out to me earlier, he has no remorse. There's no saying we're sorry that happened, but it was part of our policy. It was collateral damage or something. But he just...
Because that's something they had to carry out. And they may have had perhaps better policies domestically to keep the home folks happy. But when it came to foreign policy, it didn't seem that there was any difference between Republicans, Democrats, right-wingers, fascists, this and that. It's all the same thing because the shots are all being paid for by the same people.
Right. The deeper state is controlling it all. And you can see that if you think about 9/11 through every president after Bush. Neither Trump or Obama have challenged the official story of 9/11, even though they've been made well aware of the scientific evidence disproving it. So again, it doesn't matter which party is in power. They take their marching orders from the deep state, also called the shadow government. And they do that with the wars continues.
Well, I guess one of the reasons it justifies a lot of things we're doing, the fighting terrorism, the usual mantra going on and on and on. And that's why we have to spend all this money for armaments, et cetera, to keep us safe or whatever. But the fact is we're the ones that have invaded. We have 900 bases around the world. I mean, how many Russian bases are ringing the United States? Zero. Right?
Right.
But we were totally ringing the former Soviet Union with many bases, and we're trying to even get more. We're in Poland and Czechoslovakia, Ukraine, etc.
So again, follow the money. And it's our tax dollars that are being used to fund those military goals of our deep state around the world, killing innocent people in the process.
Our economy is based on the military-industrial complex. If we stop spending all that money, people would be out of work. And then some people like Bernie Sanders, another icon of the left, and on many issues he's good, but he's the one that fought for and maintains the boondoggle F-35 fighter jets to be built in Vermont, or at least some of it to be built in. And then those planes are exported on aircraft carriers to bomb other places around the world. But there are jobs in Vermont. So we can listen to Bernie trying to explain that away. Here's Bernie talking and replying to a questionnaire at a public forum in Vermont about the F-35. And interestingly enough, liberal as he is, he's tied down by the economic factors of the military-industrial complex, that the only peacetime budgets that we can have are based on military contracts. And in a certain sense, he's boxed into a corner.
So here's that clip of a member of the audience asking Bernie about the F-35s, followed by Bernie's answer.
However, there's a couple of issues that you've acted that are opposite of that and that blow my mind. In Burlington, there's a lot of good people working hard to stop basing the F-35. This is the military-industrial complex at its, you know, strongest. And you came out in favor of basing it there. Secondary, another issue is the climate change issue. You've said a lot of good things, but then when it comes to acting, biomass, which is tree burning, is the worst thing you can do for carbon. We've tried over and over, people have tried to talk about that, and the science says very strongly that burning trees is pretty stupid. So the point is, we can say things, point fingers, it comes down to what we do. And I don't see how you could possibly support the F-35 based on all these things.
Good questions. I don't support the F-35. This is what I do support. Whether you like it or I like it or anybody else likes it, The fact of the matter is the F-35 is the cutting-edge plane, the fighter plane, for the United States Air Force, Navy, and NATO. That's a fact. Do you deny that? You don't think it is? It is the... Well, you may think it doesn't work. The Department of Defense does think it works. All right, I don't want to... All right, but you may be...
I'm not going to let the two of you get into a debate about the technicals of planes, because I don't know the answer, but I do want...
Let me just answer the question. I'm not in it. NATO, countries all over the world, that is going to be their plane. So the question for me is the plane for the National Guard? We right now have the F-16 in Burlington. It employs hundreds of people. It provides a college education for hundreds of people. So for me, the question is not whether we have the F-35 or not. It is here. The question for me is whether it is located in Burlington, Vermont, or whether it is located in Florida. That's the issue. It is not whether you're going to build the F-35. That decision was made. You may not like it. You may talk appropriately about cost overruns. That's true. It is here. So you're not going to get rid of, I don't believe, the F-35. It is here. The question of where it is located.
So we've heard some of the statements of some of the beloved icons on the left, or the liberal left, or whatever you want to call them. I'd like to read an excerpt from an article that one Henry A. Giroux contributed to Tikkun magazine. Mr. Giroux currently holds the McMaster University Chair for Scholarship in the Public Interest in the English and Cultural Studies Department and is a distinguished scholar in critical pedagogy. Among his current books are The Public in Peril, Trump and the Menace of American Authoritarianism, and another one, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. So he's no friend of Donald Trump in any sense. Okay, his comments go following. The U.S. and its Vichy Republican Party, Vichy refers, I guess, to the Quisling government in France under the Nazis. The U.S. and the Vichy Republican Party has drifted so far to the fascist right that people such as Albright and Clinton come across as the heroic vanguard of a political and ethical resistance to fascism. Under such circumstances, even some outspoken Republicans, again without irony, such as Flake, Corker, and McCain, are viewed in the mainstream press as principled heroes, in spite of the fact that they have supported Trump's domestic and foreign policies, including his tax reform bill and his cruel and obscene budget, which not only offers $700 billion to the military, but condemns millions of people to a life of misery and suffering. While the call to resist fascism is to be welcome, it has to be interrogated and not aligned with individuals and ideological forces that help put in place the racist, economic, religious, and educational forces that help produce it. End of quote.
So the point that we're trying to make is that both the Democrats and Republicans are controlled by their puppet masters in the deep state. That's why many important policies don't change from one administration to the next. So does it really make any sense every 4 years to put all your energies and hopes into one of these two puppets? How many election cycles do you have to live through to recognize that the presidents don't do what they say they're going to do to get your vote? The system is broken, corrupt, and controlled. And we really need to change the system. Voting every 4 years and hoping that this new president will make things better for us and our country just doesn't make sense anymore. But the powers that be love it when you get all caught up in the elections instead of focusing on their manipulations and control. And I'm going to end the show today by reading part of an article written by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, and it's called A Government of Morons and War Criminals. And here goes. It has become embarrassing to be an American. Our country has had four war criminal presidents in succession. Clinton twice launched military attacks on Serbia, ordering NATO to bomb the former Yugoslavia twice, both in 1995 and in 1999, so that gives Bill two war crimes. George W. Bush invaded Afghanistan and Iraq and attacked provinces of Pakistan and Yemen from the air. That comes to four war crimes for Bush. Obama used NATO to destroy Libya and sent mercenaries to destroy Syria, thereby committing two war crimes. Trump attacked Syria with U.S. forces, thereby becoming a war criminal early in his regime. So we'll leave it there today. Frank, I want to thank you again for being on the show today. Always a pleasure.
Great. It was a pleasure.
And I want to remind the listeners that 9/11 wake-up call shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit 4, so radioforall.net. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
With Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
And later on, the Janus attack. Don't mourn, organize, and fight back.
What the heck the Supreme Court did to working people in this country, and particularly people who are members of or have been members of public sector unions. We're going to look at the Janus attack. Don't mourn, organize, and fight back. With Kimberly Bowski Goldbaum, Chicago Teachers Union rank and file activist, member of the CTU Executive Board and the House of Delegates, member of Chicago AFT Black Caucus and the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, and just about everything else. Talking about activists, Kimberly, it's great to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Chris Brooks, staff writer and organizer with Labor Notes magazine, most recently co-author of A Labor Notes Guide, Power in Open Shop America. And I think an enormously valuable and important article. It's one of the most comprehensive analysis I have seen, barring none, notwithstanding the Janus attack. But that's part of what we need to understand about Janus, which is how in heck's name we found ourselves to begin with in that position. And that's both an internal look at business unionism to some extent, and certainly the external look, the collateral consequences of who really was behind and who financed the Janus attack, which went to the Supreme Court. And saying that, I want to begin with Chris and Kimberly, if you can both give us, just to begin with, your analysis in practical terms of what the Supreme Court did to public sector unions, how serious and critical it is to the organization of the working class. Chris, you want to get us started?
I would love to. Thank you both for having me on. This is a profoundly important conversation. What the Janus decision did is it nationalized so-called right-to-work conditions for all public employees across the United States. Since right-to-work is a propaganda term invented by corporate strategists, I would prefer to use the term open shop. In an open shop, workers have the option to receive the benefits of a union without having to be a member or paying a fee for union representation. They can choose to be a free rider. And in many cases, unions have a duty of fair representation. They're required to represent everyone in a bargaining unit, regardless of whether they're a member. What this is going to effectively do is require them to continue to provide the same level of services and representation for everybody while their budgets and membership are going to dwindle over time. The right's been very public about what their plan is and what they're trying to accomplish with this. They want to gut unions of members and money so that way they can have less influence on employers and on state elections. And then they hope to be able to elect even more sympathetic politicians. So once they're in office, the corporate interests can then pass state laws, which will torch what remains of many of the labor unions. Their hope is to pass Wisconsin-style attacks like Act 10 in states all around the country, like Illinois, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Minnesota. And in doing so, weakening the labor movement overall. And then that, in turn, will continue to shift the balance of power in society more and more to corporations and billionaires.
And Kimberly?
This definitely would mean that most of the benefits that we get as unionists would be in question, because our unions wouldn't be able to handle some of the various responsibilities that our union takes on in order to protect our jobs. And so we were all concerned about this, and we've been concerned since the death of Justice Scalia and the Vergara case, kind of getting a reprieve there and trying to hit the ground running so that we could legally try to preserve our rights. This was, however, an expected decision. We expected the court to make a decision as it did. And luckily, the Chicago Teachers Union, we were all kind of on top of our game and trying to organize around preserving solidarity so that we could continue to go ahead and defend workers in the way that we have been doing. So I just want to say Mr. Brooks's article and this white paper that he's come up with is going to be incredibly useful. And there will be new workers that need to sign union cards. Our union, in anticipation of the decision that came down, we had a recard campaign. And we did this last September. We said that we anticipated that the decision would not go well for us in the Janus case. And we, all year, every school and throughout all levels of the union, made an outreach and an inreach to our various members and got almost 99% recarding, signing back up to join the Chicago Teachers Union. Now, I'm sure that with retirements and other things, some of those people will go, but that's an awesome amount of people and a very successful campaign, but we can't stop. We have to keep on going.
Chris, a lot of unions are doing what they're calling internal organizing and have been since the Friedrichs decision was cut down because Scalia died and then Janus came after that. Do you think that is enough? I mean, sometimes you're doing internal organizing, but there's no real activation of the membership, or is there?
Yeah, I think there's a range in the responses that we've seen to the pending Janus decision, which has now been realized. So I like to think of it as a spectrum from shallow to deep. On the shallow end is a lot of unions, for the very first time often, reached out to all of their members to get them to sign recommit cards through these all-in campaigns. So if they were going into the workplace and having those conversations, I think that that's a great initial step. But it can be pretty shallow, because especially if the union's not been there in a long time, what comes up is a lot of issues, a lot of problems that workers are facing that they're then dumping onto the union representative or to the steward or whoever's having those conversations. What happens on a deeper side of the spectrum is that those conversations are used as an organizing opportunity, as a union building tool. Organizers can identify issues in the workplace that the workers can be united around in order to come up with a plan in order to solve it. And they can start identifying informal leaders, those people that have the respect of their coworkers, and that if they're engaged, they can bring their whole networks into the organization, into the union, into the plan of action. It's good to be on the shallow end if you've not done anything before, but it's not necessarily going to be enough, especially if you're facing some major right-wing opposition, like is being expected in states all across the country, where corporate-funded right-wing organizations have been able to gather the personal contact information of many government employees and are now personally reaching out to them through emails, robocalls, and even door knocks, trying to encourage them to give themselves a raise by dropping the union.
Before we get into what is to be done, I think the two essential things to know is that Mr. Janus is not just an individual who felt that his speech was being limited by being in a union. Who financed this case and really what was at stake? Because it's part of a body of attacks against labor and organized labor and the public sector unions, which were holding stronger than the private sector unions. And I think in order to figure out where to go from here, it's critical to understand the full court press, if you will, that brought the case of Mr. Janus to the Supreme Court. Chris?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So currently, under about 7% of the private sector is unionized, while the public sector continues to retain a Canadian level of union density at about 33%. That has put it under the crosshairs of the right of corporations and business interest groups that are interested in undermining public services, in cutting taxes, and in trying to weaken the labor movement on the whole. So this case actually was originally brought by Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner, the billionaire governor who has been adamantly anti-working class, adamantly anti-union, passing a series of all these legislations and executive actions against unions, holding up the union, the state agency budgets in the state of Illinois for multiple years. When the court ruled that he didn't actually have standing to bring the trial, the Right to Work Foundation, you know, part of litany of right-wing organizations like the State Policy Network and the American Legislative Exchange Council are all funded by billionaires and corporations. They found a worker that would be willing to be the face of this. All of the lawyers, all of the politicians, all of the nonprofits, so-called nonprofits involved in this have been trying to push these kinds of cases through the courts for years. It's been a longstanding effort, and the end goal has been pretty clear. They want to use the judicial system in order to undermine basic rights that unions have enjoyed for decades in the hopes of further weakening working class power in the country.
And I want to cut to Kimberly Bowsky, because certainly during the late 60s, early 70s, the last hired, so to speak, and first fired were definitely women, were women of color, Black and Latino women throughout the country. And they began to, after the struggles of the 60s, make breakthroughs and get hired positions. And a good part of the public sector unions are composed of women, women of color, etc. What does it mean to have had these unions and to have them not weakened by decisions like the Janus attack, which are both about decreasing the size of the treasury, but they're also demanding that people opt in to even be in the unions? What does it mean for you as a working woman and Black women, Latina women, women of color, and all members of the working class to have had strong unions that were able to indeed use part of their treasury, both for bread and butter issues to service their members, but also for political purposes that were in the interests of the working people that the unions represented? Kimberly?
Well, for your listeners, I am a Black teacher of 26 years, a woman, and I would not be able to have a life-sustaining job with benefits without my union. So it's critical, because most of my friends, whether they're teachers or postal workers or other people that consider themselves part of the working class, we've really done well by unions, but we've fought to get into those unions and we fought to get the jobs that those unions protected. So it was the Janus decision, a direct attack on our neighborhoods, our communities, and our way of life. So it's critical for those of us who belong to those constituencies to make sure that our unions live. Oftentimes, especially for retired women in our CTU, many of whom are Black, we went out and we did a lot of legislative work and talking out in communities. And we're doing this and we're volunteering to do this because we know the conditions that we have in the schools. It wasn't a Janus decision, then it's going to be privatization, like the privatization, the charterization of the schools in Chicago and the 2013 closing of 50 schools. And most of those schools were in Black neighborhoods, and it did also affect Latina people. So we all think that unionism is the way to go, and we don't want to let our unions go without a fight. It really has been quite an experience seeing attack after attack and just having to kind of be a mainstay to our union. Our numbers as Black women, and you know that our teachers' union is mostly populated with women, but about 10 years ago, we had a union density of 49% Black teachers, okay? As much as 20 years ago, I believe that was 49%. And now we're down to 19%. It is because of the efforts of this right wing of our government and anti-union forces that we're unable to maintain that level of employment. The union is the reason why we have been able to maintain about 19 to 20% union membership in the Chicago Teachers Union, if I could use us as an example. I think that it's critical that we stay in the fight. The union is the only way, solidarity is the only way that we're able to maintain our power.
One of the things that CTU has done so effectively is created student-centered demands that really focus on the composition and demographics of the students and how Rahm Emanuel's policies are disproportionately impacting working class students and students of color, and they've been able to really connect them with the union's contract campaigns and with bargaining, with the demands that they're pushing. So it's not just that CTU is the greatest single barrier to the corporate takeover of public schools in Chicago, but it's also a force for the communities that it operates in. Kimberly's a force for the students that she teaches. And I think that's what's made them in part so powerful and put them in such a strong position to be able to withstand attacks like Janus.
Kimberly, just to follow through on a little bit more, because your union seems to be in, I won't say a unique situation, but a situation that we can really learn from, because as you said before, only 1% is non-union. You've been organizing for years to make the union more democratic, to involve the membership, and to do other things that you've mentioned in terms of reaching out to the community. So if you could tell us a little bit more about this, because I think people need to learn more about what the CTU has done and is doing, because it's really a model for what we must all be doing.
The leadership of the CTU is a strong leadership model because we insisted, the caucus rank and file educators that took over in 2010 insisted that on working class kind of politics, that was part of a strength because it came with an analysis about the attacks on education being related to other things that were going on in the economy, period. And so we've been able to link up with different community organizations that have that same sort of idea. And so we realize that whatever happens to the school or in the school also happens other places. We tried and we continue to try to reach out to members to make sure that they're engaged and involved in community organizations with their students, that there's a great deal of interchange of ideas between us. And that's part of the leadership that we're doing. We try to strengthen the unity inside of our unions in the buildings, and we've really tried to get people to know the contract and then to act upon the contract and to know what the union is about. So it couldn't be done just by ourselves, but in conjunction with a whole lot of other things and keeping that analysis, being able to say that the privatizers that are attacking unions and attacking our jobs and attacking our students, everything that they've done in this language of freedom and choice. And we've been able to make the case to people that these are false choices and freedom is being misinterpreted. And with that message, we've been able to win a whole lot of things for workers and for students. And we've also reached out to other labor unions and also unorganized labor and day labor. We've been able to keep up those connections. All of that is critical to being successful as a teachers union that's established, but we can't do anything without other people. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it certainly does. And we're going to continue on that because, you know, one of the things that certainly Kimberly and Chris have mentioned, we didn't say it in these terms, but it's clear that from what Kimberly and Chris were talking about, that there really is a racist history of right to work. It is not, let's be clear, because some people have been confused by the term, right to work is not the right for a job. It's not about equal employment. It is the mandate to work without the rights and the benefits of being able to collectively bargain, to have a union and the interests of the working class on the line with and negotiate for the terms and conditions of employment with the employers. The right to work laws go all the way back to the 1940s as a strategy, really, to maintain Jim Crow in the South, which Chris points out beautifully in his article. I want you to also pick up, Chris. We wanted to be honest and self-observant. We see what Kimberly talks about, what her union's doing to and what she does to involve the membership for a more democratic and participatory process. But what have unions to some extent become lax about, even though we understand they're under major attacks from the right? But what have they become relaxed about that has allowed them to, or allowed the right to have an open door, or at least kick open the door a bit to really, along with this Supreme Court decision, truly erode their base and their possibility of functioning. And then we'll get about, we will not mourn or we will organize. And both Kimberly and Chris are going to talk about what do we do in the face of the Janus attack. Chris?
So what I would say is that after decades of demobilization, many public sector unions have become highly legalistic, service-focused organizations that overly rely on paid staff to perform the work of the union. This has often led them to be poorly situated to respond to the current crisis. If your members feel like they're being used as an ATM machine for predetermined priorities of the union leadership, that they didn't really get to have a say in it, then when they're given the chance to walk, they probably will. So this lack of like a really deep connection to the members and what's happening in the worksite has left many unions, like the union leadership, kind of discombobulated and floating free of the membership. So what we've heard from Kimberly, what it takes to really rebuild the union from the ground up and the importance of thinking that the best response to Janus and to Right to Work or, you know, Open Shop is union transformation through union reform. And that means building strong unions that have a living presence day-to-day at the worksite, have stewards that are trained, that have identified the informal leaders in the workshop, that are having lots of organizing conversations, and that are actually coming up with plans to deal with the issues that their members care about on a day-to-day basis, while also trying to fight for bigger and bolder visions, right, of what they can accomplish. I think that Kimberly was just saying matches up perfectly with that, like having to engage in the school site fight, having to take on the bullying principle that's there, while also trying to think about how can we make bigger and bolder demands at the bargaining table. I mean, one of the things that's been so incredible about the CTU is that in their last round of bargaining, they were making demands that weren't even legal. They don't care. They were saying that we want the city to open up its tax base into more funding into public education, and they knew that they had the public support on their side. And the city ended up caving, even though making such a demand isn't legal under the collective bargaining laws that exist in Illinois. So I think CTU is such a great example of how they've been able to build from the base and then scale up and project a vision for what it looked like to transform their city.
I wonder if we can build on the model for the Chicago teachers, because everybody is now open shop. What they call Right to Work, we call open shop. And there's been a lot of open shop in the private sector for years. And in some cases, this has not weakened, or it has not killed, at least, the unions. For instance, the Nevada hotel workers are all open shop, but it's a very strong union. The post office, among the federal employees, a lot of the federal employee unions have very low union membership, but the post office has like 90%. So what is it that people should be looking at? In addition, I don't think it's just the Chicago teachers. What other role models do we have out there for this open shop environment?
Labor Notes just produced a guide. So it's called Rebuilding Power in Open Shop America, and it's available at our website, labornotes.org. In it, we tried to identify what unions that are not only surviving but thriving in right-to-work environments are doing. What are they doing right? How are they being able to build membership and continuing to win fights? And we found that there was some commonalities between them. You know, we said they needed to be democratic. So strong organizing, identifying those issues that members care about is inherently about engaging them and getting them involved. So unions have to be democratic organizations that are constantly reaching out, winning people over, and never writing them off, even if they're not a member. They also have to fight the boss. I mean, it's just an inherent part of the work is being able to say that there is a person that's creating these issues, that's creating these problems, and we can take them on. We can identify them. They have names and addresses. We can hunt them down. And they have to be able to come up with a plan.
I have a couple of suggestions,
Kimberly,
too.
Sure.
Labor Notes does have a book called The Secrets of a Successful Organizer that gives people scenarios of situations that they might find at work. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're CTU or not. Just if you're a worker, these are things that you could do to organize your workplace. And if you're having problems knowing what kind of conversations to start, they give different examples, and they also give real-life kind of history and examples. The other thing that people could do is look to the past. You don't have to mimic the past totally, but there's some good ideas. There's some old-time unionism. Going from door-to-door is a good idea, but when you're in the workplace, there goes your door. The person that works with you or next to you or somewhere in the physical plant, if you would call it that, or your office, that's a person to go to and have conversations about what's going on when they feel safe to do so. We took a tip from the past also, meaning the CTU, and we have a research department and an organizing department. There are numbers and strategies and things that get done there. I also say for people who are not totally unionized, like where the red states were, where all those teachers went out fabulously, they went person to person, and they also used social media. So there are a lot of options that we could use, and especially communication.
So while we need more robust treasuries for sure, the key is not just the money, and we're not trying to rationalize things. We are trying to make sure that the glass is half full rather than half empty. And both Kimberly and Chris have given us ideas about what we do. We don't mourn, we organize. And it would seem that what you're both talking about is a more direct participatory role with the membership. And then the question is, who is the leadership and to what extent they really meld with and are and percolate up from the membership base? And since Kimberly mentioned also the issue of the teachers, one of the things that happened with the teachers in those red states were they really worked in conjunction with the community. They built really meaningful
alliances.
The
demands also were for the community.
Absolutely.
For the students.
Yeah. So they came much more cohesively and directly and comprehensively from the grassroots themselves and were bread and butter issues, but they were and the teachers' issues weren't as much bread and butter issues as they were about the nature of education. So would you both, in the final time that we have left, say that what we do for those of us who uphold the working class, for those of us who uphold the union, how do you look, both of you, at those key ingredients in a post-Janus era to take us to really regaining the membership, enlisting more people, and making the unions the powerful bulwark against capital that they should be? Chris, Kimberly?
The answers come from so many different places. We need to stay the course, meaning just because someone passes a law doesn't necessarily mean that we can't overcome that. We have to keep it in our minds and tell our colleagues, our coworkers, our comrades that in the history of this country, there have been many laws that have been unjust. There have been many decisions that have been unjust, and they don't define our union. We define our unions. We have to reach for aspiration and inspiration, right? We're the ones who do the work. And so we aren't just employed. We are workers. People have to start thinking in two minds. You're not just an employee that has to take orders and produce. That's your work, and you have some say about it. So I think that we need to get people on board, and it's a continual process to try to organize, to fight the bosses, to even argue with each other, because just because you have some successes doesn't mean that everybody's at the same developmental stage or that they're with you. We need to continue to do the recommitment, the recarding campaigns. We need to encourage people to start unions. Make sure that we're reaching out to those who are unorganized and those who are frightened at what this means, because we know that when we have unionized workplaces, the conditions get better for those who are not in organized.
Just want to let Chris, next 30 seconds, add on to that. And, of course, tell us where we can get all this fabulous literature that we've referenced and that Kimberly has referenced. Chris Brooks, the last word.
Yeah, if you had told me in January that we would see a wave of illegal teacher strikes in Republican-controlled states, I wouldn't have believed you. Yet here we are. So things can change very quickly. Our members are not apathetic. They're willing to take risk and fight for big, bold demands, and that's very clear. So I think we need to build on that momentum. So if you want to find the Labor Notes Guide to Surviving in Open Shop America, you can go to labornotes.org. And then I also have a piece up on the right-wing plan to build on Janus to demolish unions up at In These Times.
And it's fabulous. I can't thank Kimberly Boesky-Goldbaum, Chicago Teachers Union, enough, and Chris Brooks, staff writer and organizer with Labor Notes. And Ken and I were just going to add, if don't mourn, organize, because you have nothing to lose but your chains.
And we have a world to win.
With people like Kimberly and Chris, we will do just that. Thank you both for joining us, and I'm optimistic that we're going to be rebuilding and strengthening our unions.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
Our folks who have shown themselves and asked for asylum, they're trying to get protection. They're not trying to hide.
We are here because we believe that families belong together.
But what are we going to do after today?
What I really want to try to impress on you is to...
This is a little treatise called The Little Red Hen.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. U.S. top court throws wedding bouquet case back to Washington state jurists. Angola grants legal recognition to LGBTQ rights group. And queer asylum seekers caught in Trump's immigration crisis. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michelle Yater.
And I'm Seth Eric Cutler.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending June 30th, 2018. Queer-related developments at the U.S. Supreme Court top this week's news. The High Court first essentially kicked a case down the road that tested a Washington state florist's religious right to deny service to LGBTQ people. Baronelle Stutzman, owner of Arlene's Flowers and Gifts in Richland, Washington, refused to provide flowers for longtime customer Robert Ingersoll in 2013 when she found out that they would be for his wedding to another man. She said she declined his request because of her relationship with Jesus Christ. After traveling up the judicial ladder, the Washington Supreme Court ruled unanimously that the florist had violated the state's law against discrimination. Rather than hearing her appeal, America's High Court returned the case to the Washington Supreme Court, saying it needed to reconsider its ruling in light of the justice's decision in the case of a Colorado baker's refusal to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. In that case, the High Court ruled for the baker because it viewed the state Civil Rights Commission's decision against him as being based on anti-religious animus. There's no allegation of similar bias in the Washington florist case. Attorney General Robert Ferguson said that he was confident that the court will come to the same conclusion they did in their previous unanimous ruling upholding the civil rights of same-sex couples in our state.
LGBTQ advocacy groups join the chorus of other human rights organizations to condemn the second U.S. Supreme Court ruling of the week, this one upholding President Donald Trump's much-maligned ban on people from predominantly Muslim countries entering the country. Lambda Legal's Rachel Tivin wrote that the decision was as shameful as the internment of Japanese Americans and the door slammed to Jewish refugees fleeing Nazi Germany. This month, she added, the court expressed deep concern about the slightest perceived animosity towards a Christian baker, but today is untroubled by the President of the United States singling out Muslims for unequal treatment. The Transgender Law Center's Chris Hayashi wrote, the decision adds yet another disgraceful chapter to our country's history of targeting people because of who they are. Sarah Warbelow of the Human Rights Campaign said the ban undermines civil liberties in this country and does nothing to keep all Americans safer. GLAAD's Kate Ellis wrote, our unified communities will stand together in firm opposition to this abjectly un-American ruling. And Aaron Morris of Immigration Equality wrote, we are so much greater than this moment, and progress is something we must demand every day.
The week of high court disappointments for equality advocates ended with the announcement by Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy that he was retiring at the age of 81. Often considered to be the swing vote in 5-4 decisions, Kennedy was appointed by Ronald Reagan some 30 years ago and was expected to be a reliably conservative voice on the high court. But he wrote all 4 pro-queer Supreme Court decisions, beginning with the overturning of state sodomy laws in 2003 and through the court's marriage equality ruling in 2015. A devout Roman Catholic, Kennedy generally argued that it was immoral to deny equal protection of the law to a targeted and otherwise law-abiding group of people. U.S. progressives are worried about the future makeup of an already right-leaning court. Political conservatives and the religious right are salivating over the chance for President Donald Trump to appoint a judge who would further their efforts to overturn Roe v. Wade, marriage equality, and other laws protecting minorities. Trump's first appointment, Neil Gorsuch, has, as expected, joined the court's ideologically conservative majority in votes so far. During his presidential campaign, Trump promised to appoint justices like Antonin Scalia, a staunch opponent of a woman's right to choose and of LGBTQ rights. The Advocate described a published list of possible candidates Trump is considering to take Kennedy's seat as appalling. Trump's Republican Party holds a slim 51-49 majority in the U.S. Senate, where a high court nominee must be confirmed. Its leadership is intent on getting a nominee onto the high court before the midterm elections in November. Minority Democrats will do all they can to stall that process until after those elections, hoping that they can ride a wave of anti-Trump sentiment on Election Day to become the majority party in one or even both houses of Congress.
In other news, the Southern African nation of Angola has granted legal recognition to a queer rights group for the first time. Iris Angola's Carlos Fernandez called the Justice Ministry's announcement historic and said it would give more weight to the work of our organization, which was founded in 2013. Ian Levine of Human Rights Watch tweeted that it was good news from the new government of President João Lourenço, who succeeded the 4-decade rule of José Eduardo dos Santos and seems intent on improving Angola's much-criticized human rights record. The oil-rich country doesn't have any specifically anti-LGBTQ laws on the books, and a new penal code approved by Parliament in May includes a ban on sexual orientation-based workplace discrimination. But activists complain about anti-queer bias in accessing healthcare and educational opportunities. According to Reuters, Iris Angola has about 200 members. A second LGBTQ rights group in the country has yet to seek legal recognition.
Ukrainian police arrested 56 protesters ahead of Kiev's LGBTQ Pride March on June 17th, but none of them were among the more than 5,000 people parading with Pride. All the detainees were members of far-right radical groups that were trying to stop it. Riot police scuffled throughout the morning with more than 150 protesters trying to block the route of the march through the center of the Ukrainian capital city. One far-right group, C14, complained in a Facebook post about whose side the police were on. "Look at how they protect sexual minorities," it read, "and violate the rights of regular Kiev citizens." Violent attacks disrupted the city's pride marches as recently as 2015. A beefed-up police presence has kept the festivities peaceful since 2016.
Hundreds of LGBTQ activists and their supporters took to the streets of Tel Aviv on June 8th to temporarily block that city's annual pride parade. They said it was to protest the Israeli government's cynical use of the queer community to give the impression that the country is a liberal and progressive place, while at the same time infringing upon the most basic human rights of the Palestinian people living in Gaza and the West Bank. Most news outlets focused on the more than 250,000 locals and tourists waving rainbow flags and enjoying the beach city's 20th annual Pride Parade. Israeli lawmakers killed a bill to allow same-gender couples to enter into civil unions just 2 days before the Pride March. Civil marriage doesn't exist in Israel, something the country's progressives also want to change. All weddings in the country must be conducted by religious authorities, and none will officiate the marriage of a gay or lesbian couple.
An estimated 600 people in the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya braved death threats on June 15th to hold a first-ever Pride celebration. The camp's population is filled with Islamic settlers and refugees from Uganda, South Sudan, Somalia, and Ethiopia, where same-gender love is condemned. While the event itself was relatively peaceful, notes were soon posted all around the camp warning queer refugees to leave the camp or we are going to kill you one by one. There were reports that a lesbian and a transgender person were attacked the following night. But one of the defiant organizers, Ugandan refugee Mbariza Moesa, hoped that the celebration would become an annual event at the camp.
And finally, the rough-and-tumble U.S. town of Deadwood, South Dakota, now home to some 1,270 people, according to the most recent census, has been immortalized in movies and on TV shows as one of the Wild West's wilder places. And now, Deadwood has hosted its first-ever Pride Festival. The weekend celebration on June 23rd and 24th included a pool party and a pub crawl, along with a drag contest and dance party, capped off by a Sunday brunch. Derek Livermont, a member of the organizing committee, told local TV station KEVN that with no bars or community spaces in the Black Hills specifically welcoming LGBTQ people, life can be a little bit lonely and separated sometimes. Pride celebrants were going to meet people that were in their area that they had no idea were there, he said, and really start to feel like there's other people out there.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending June 30th, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the all-new thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Seth Eric Cutler.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
I've got a sweet tooth, licorice drops and jelly rolls. Hey, sugar daddy, I'm some meat, some sugar in his bowl.
Hi, this is John Cameron Mitchell, the writer-director of Hedwig and the Angry Inch and Short Bus. And you're listening to This Way Out, the international weekly radio magazine for all our sexually diverse communities.
Some nights I stay up, cashing in my bad luck. Some nights I call it a draw. But I still wake up, I still see a gospel. Lord, I'm still not sure what I stand for.
The Trump administration's disastrous policy of separating asylum-seeking immigrants from their children at the Mexican border and the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in favor of Trump's ban on refugees from 7 Muslim-majority countries have dramatically added to the crisis faced by LGBTQ people seeking safety. U.S. asylum claims have always been a tough sell for those fleeing homophobic violence. Now claimants from the targeted countries are terrified that their hopes are gone. Even before the strain placed on detention facilities by the new border policy, Immigration and Customs Enforcement had abandoned its own rules aimed at protecting the LGBTQs in their custody, leaving them subject to alarming rates of sexual assault and solitary confinement. Catherine Davis-Young of Public News Service reports on the latest data showing the particular jeopardy for transgender U.S. immigration detainees.
The analysis from the Center for American Progress shows detention centers are especially dangerous for transgender immigrants. In addition to cases of sexual assault, it reports cases of transgender women being held in facilities for men, or sometimes in solitary confinement. In response to recent written questions from Congresswoman Kathleen Rice on Immigration and Customs Enforcement's handling of LGBT detainees, the agency replied it was, quote, committed to faithfully executing our duty to enforce immigration laws, end quote. But Sherita Gruberg with the Center for American Progress fears the Department of Homeland Security hasn't been taking appropriate steps to protect LGBT immigrants.
DHS is supposed to do a risk classification assessment on people during intake. And for people who are particularly vulnerable to sexual abuse, that's supposed to factor in from the first step of when they're deciding, do we detain this person or not, to where exactly do we detain this individual.
The Trump administration has vowed to tighten policies at the U.S.-Mexico border for reasons of national security. In April, President Donald Trump issued a memorandum asking immigration enforcement not to release detainees as they await immigration hearings. But Gruberg says the increasing federal pressure to keep more people in custody is putting LGBT immigrants in situations where they're more likely to face assault. Gruberg says LGBT people make up only about 0.1% of the population in ICE custody. She says many of them are seeking asylum from sexual violence or discrimination in their own countries.
These are people who have a very strong claim to protection in the U.S., and they usually are folks who have, at the border, shown themselves and asked for asylum. They're trying to get protection. They're not trying to hide.
37 members of Congress sent a letter to the Department of Homeland Security asking to address concerns over the safety of LGBT detainees. For Public News Service, I'm Catherine Davis-Young.
Amid the outrage over toddler detention camps, the heightened dangers for trans people detained by U.S. immigration did not escape attention at nationwide Families Belong Together rallies on June 30th. Emmy-winning trans actress-producer Laverne Cox spoke at the Los Angeles event.
We are here because we believe that families belong together. We are here because our hearts are broken, seeing and hearing accounts of children being stripped from the custody of their parents. We are here to demand that our government reunite migrant children with their families right now. But let us not forget that this country was built on the backs of slave labor that routinely stripped children from the custody of their parents. A country that was built on the genocide of Native people. Let us not forget that the corporations that own private for-profit prisons also run the privately owned immigration detention centers, which are profiting from imprisoning migrant families and children. This connection between the prison industrial complex and our government's latest moral atrocities reminds me that this is all of it intersectional. The intersecting systems of what bell hooks calls imperialist, white supremacist, capitalist patriarchy. I like to add to that imperialist, cisnormative, heteronormative, imperialist, white supremacist. Those forces are constantly working to oppress all of us, all of the time, simultaneously, from immigration detention centers to the Supreme Court and beyond. So we must come together now more than ever and not let the oppressor strategy of divide and conquer keep us from this fight we must wage together. We must each love each other harder than we ever have before, even as we disagree. Because the neo-fascist history that is repeating itself right now must not stand. It is Dr. Cornel West who reminds us that justice is what love looks like in public. Justice is what love looks like in public. No justice.
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
It is now my distinct honor and pleasure to introduce the president and CEO of the Trans Latina Coalition, working every day at the intersection of immigration and transgender identity. Please join me in welcoming, along with members of the Trans Latina Coalition, Bambi Salcedo.
Primero que nada, a mí me gusta darle gracias a mi poder superior por darme la oportunidad de estar aquí con ustedes. También quiero honrar la tierra en la cual estamos hoy parados y paradas. I want to ask permission to the people of the Tongva land to allow me to say a few words to you. I want to also honor the land where we're standing on today. You know, it is cute and everything that we're all here today. And it is a weekend that we can come out and it's all good. But what are we going to do after today? That's the question that we want to ask ourselves and the people that we know, our families, our siblings. And it's important that we understand how immigration affects the lives of all of our people. But I want to talk specifically about the lives and issues of trans women who are in immigration detention as well. As if we are not part of families. Just a few weeks ago, about 3 weeks ago, one of our sisters, Rosana Hernandez, perished at the hands of the f***ed up ICE machine. She died caged on a hospital bed by herself. There was no one there to give her the love that she deserved, to give her dignity. 13 trans women have been brutally murdered in the United States so far this year. And you know who created all the violence that trans people experience? Those motherfuckers. And so the question is, what are we going to do to dismantle the ICE machine? What are we going to do when they're getting to elect the new Supreme Judge? It is not just cute for us to come here and stand on the sun and get open and shit and just go home and do nothing. Coming out to the streets will not solve the issues and the problems that we have within our society. It is our responsibility to change the landscape of our people. Are we going to do that?
Yes!
Let's not kiss ass. Politicians come up here and say, like, yes, you're cute, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna do that. And then they get into office and they forget all about us. We need to hold them accountable. Just as we put them into office, we can get them the fuck out of office. We need to be radical, intentional, and strategic, and f*** up!
Yes!
We cannot just sit down on the sidewalks and see us march. We need to make changes, and we need to organize. We need to mobilize and elect people whose heart is in the right place, and that they know that they work for us, not for those motherfuckers who continue to get money off our bodies. The immigration system is exactly set up the way the prison industrial complex is set up. and politicians contribute to all of that. So we need to make sure that we create new strategies that will address the humanity of our people. Can we do that?
Yes!
When I say people, you say power, people!
Power!
People!
Power!
People!
Power!
Let's get some shit up!
Yeah!
How many of us have to die before you get involved? That's the message.
Laverne Cox and Bambi Salcedo spoke at the Los Angeles Families Belong Together rally. Also present on stage was pop superstar and gay icon Cher, who brought the issues home in a very personal way.
So they told me, don't talk about Trump. And what I say is F that, okay? Because we wouldn't be here if he had compassion, if he didn't care about kidnapping innocent children from their parents and throw them in cages on the floor with tinfoil to cry into. So we know that, and we understand that. But what I really want to try to impress on you is to vote.
Yes! Vote!
If you don't vote, you will not recognize this country, and you will lose everything that you just now take for granted, every right that you have. And
yes.
I'm not being dramatic.
Yes.
Well, maybe I am, but I'm
no.
not. Okay?
No.
This man will take everything. I have never seen anything like it. I have never seen anything like it. So I wanted to tell you that. I also want to tell you a story. When I was a baby, my father took my mother across the United States, and he said, I have to go to New York. I'm going to get some money, and I'll be back. Get a job while I'm gone. I'm putting Cher in a Catholic home. So my mother got a job, an all-night diner, $3 a night, and tips. She went to see me at the home. The mother superior said, you cannot come in, you cannot see her, because you're not married. And my mother said, yes, I am married. And she said, when your husband comes back and gives me proof, you can see her. My mother came every day and looked at me through a window. And I was crying at the crib. I cannot tell you how long this lasts. Thank you.
That was Cher speaking at the June 30th Los Angeles Families Belong Together rally.
This is a little treatise on basic economics called The Little Red Hen.
And finally this week, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was recently asked to leave a D.C. area restaurant, and late-night TV hosts could not resist adding their own dishes to the menu. So nibble on these morsels served up by Stephen Colbert, Trevor Noah, Jimmy Fallon, Jordan Klepper, and Seth Meyers.
This is a tale of a little red hen, lived on a farm in a chicky chick pen. She and her brood would never shirk, but the live long day just work, work, work.
Here's what happened. Hucka Sands went out for dinner with her husband and some friends. The staff recognized her and called the owner, who gathered everyone in the back and allowed employees to vote on whether to boot Huckabee Sanders out of the restaurant. Oh, good. So someone's getting due process.
Asking Sanders to leave was probably the nicest thing they could have done. The waiter was probably like, listen, if I'm being honest, all the chefs are jizzing in your food right now.
Turns out her server asked her what she wanted as an appetizer, and out of habit, she refused to answer.
Hey, Red Hen, you might not like kids getting separated from their parents, but that does not give you the right to separate a woman from her cheese plate.
Sanders wasn't going to let this slide. The next day, from her official White House Twitter account, she tweeted, last night I was told by the owner of Red Hen in Lexington, Virginia, to leave because I work for at POTUS, and I politely left. Her actions say far more about her than about me. I always do my best to treat people, including those I disagree with, respectfully. You work for Donald Trump. You don't even treat yourself with respect.
Usually people who work for the Trump administration are asked to leave the Trump administration.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Michelle Yeader and Seth Eric Cutler, with thanks to Brian DeShazer. Fun performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Help keep our 30-year streak going at the all-new thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email TWORadio@AOL.com or write to us at Post Office Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KUCR Riverside, California, 3GCR Morrell, Victoria, WSMU North Dartmouth, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens.
Believe me. Believe me. Believe me.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The history of dispossessing people from their lands is long indeed. But under capitalism, especially as it emerged in England, a particular ideology sprang up to justify seizing the lands of others. That justification, whether applied to the English peasantry or the land of native peoples in colonial America, posited that the land could and should be taken if it were not being cultivated in the right way. And, my guest Gary Field shows, this is the same logic that was used to dispossess the Palestinians of their land in British Mandate Palestine and then with the establishment of the State of Israel, an argument he makes in his book, Enclosure, Palestinian Landscapes in a Historical Mirror, published by UC Press. Fields is Associate Professor of Communication at the University of California, San Diego, and joins me now. Gary, let me start by asking you about the term enclosure, the title of your book, and a key term for understanding the argument that you make. What does the term enclosure mean?
I use the term enclosure as kind of the overall theme of the book as a result of a chance encounter I had early in the research, Sasha. I went to interview the mayor of a town in the West Bank called Qalqilia. And the mayor of this town, who had been mayor for quite some time, told me a story about what had happened to Qalqilia in 2003. Now, this town gained some notoriety during the early days of the Second Intifada because Qalqilia had been completely surrounded by this wall, as Palestinians call it, a concrete wall. There was only a small little entryway in and out of the town. And what he told me about of what had happened after the construction had been completed, which took about 3 or 4 days, he said that all of the entire town was put under curfew. They could not go out of their houses. And when the townspeople came out after 4 days and they saw what had been done to them, they were shocked. And he used what this mayor, whose name was Maruf Zarhan, what he told me is he said, they have enclosed my city. Now, the word enclosed really resonated with me because I had actually done economic history as a minor field during my PhD. And the English enclosures were a phase of early modern history in England, which represented the prelude to the agricultural prelude to the Industrial Revolution. And what had happened in England was that the estate owners wanted to regain ownership of the common property on their estates that had been used by tenant farmers for centuries under English common law to graze their animals, to gather foodstuffs like berries, and to hunt small game. And the estate owners, beginning in the late 16th and early 17th century, began to take back that land with the help of Parliament. And what they did is they enclosed large areas of the English countryside and made those areas into private individual properties that was now off limits to their tenants. When the mayor of Qalqilia, Mayor Zarhan, used the term enclosed, I began to think of the situation in Palestine in sort of broadly historical terms, kind of like a phenomenon that had been ongoing beginning in England in terms of constructing exclusionary spaces on the landscape, places where people could and could not be. So it was at that moment that I began to think of the situation in Palestine as historically analogous to something that had taken place centuries earlier during the English enclosure movement in the 16th, 17th, and 18th century. So I used the term enclosure as a way
of drawing an historical analogy between Palestine and what had been happening earlier. And really, the idea was planted in my head by Mayor Zarhan of Qalqilya. And I began to work with that concept, and I began to think of the Palestinian situation as something that was not historically unique, but had actually echoed, had echoes of something that had taken place in the early modern past.
Well, let's talk more, and we'll certainly get to Palestine, but let's talk about that parallel, the parallel with the English enclosures when the common land was enclosed by the estate owners. When it happened, how was it justified?
It was justified on the basis of something called land improvement. And this was a discourse that had started to emerge in the 16th and 17th centuries in conjunction with the development of the profit-making system, the development of capitalism. And of course, capitalism was the core idea of capitalism was making a profit, making the economy more rational and efficient. And so the idea of leaving land in as common land to be used as a common resource sort of did not resonate with the spirit, the emerging spirit of capitalism that was beginning to dominate the economic discourse of the time. So that it really the discourse that began to emerge as the justification was the discourse of improvement. And you see this in England beginning in the 16th and 17th century. That is this pervasive and really dominant idea about making land more productive. And the idea was that if you took land out of its common uses and turned them into private individual uses, that the land and the landscape would be more efficient, more productively farmed, more intensively farmed. And that was really the justification for the estate owners going on the attack using the political institution of Parliament to retake this common land on their estate in the interest of improving it for the health and welfare of the nation.
Well, you use the term technologies of force to describe the mechanisms that allow enclosure to take place. In the case of the enclosure in the English countryside, what technologies were used? You mentioned already Parliament, so there's obviously one component of it was legal. But tell us about the mechanisms that allowed this to take place.
One of the most important mechanisms that allowed this to take place, and that I talked about extensively in the book, was the mechanism of cartography. And it's no accident that mapping and capitalist development and even nationalism begin to emerge in conjunction with one another beginning in the late 16th century. What starts to happen is that cartography, and especially the mapping of estates, what the mapping of estates, and called estate mapping, what that begins to enable estate owners to do is that they begin to see their land not so much as bundles of rights that were written up in texts, and bundles of rights that would be allocated to both landlord and tenant, but they began to see their estates in graphic form. And when they ordered these early map makers to begin to map their tenancies, they began to grasp much more completely how their land was either being used productively or unproductively. So in other words, what mapping did is it enabled and provided estate owners with what John Berger, the art historian, called a new way of seeing. Mapping
gave estate owners a new way of seeing their land and tenancies, and they began to reimagine their estates as being redrawn with the tenancies removed and those areas kind of consolidated into much larger tenancies that could be farmed with wage labor. So that was one of the most important what I call technologies that enabled estate owners to see their estates in a new way. That was one technology. Another technology that they used equally, if not more intensively, was the technology of the law itself, in this case, property law. These estate owners used the law, appealed to Parliament, as a way of convincing parliamentarians and the nation that what they were doing was not just self-interested, that is, that this was not just for individual profitable gain, but this was something that would make the nation of England powerful again, because England was involved in rivalries with some of its colonial neighbors like France, the Netherlands, even Spain in the 16th century. They wanted to make England a powerful country. And the way you had to do that was to be able to mobilize the resources of the nation that could support colonial ventures. So you had to have a productive agricultural system. The justification was that if you consolidated the estates, created larger and larger farms that would be farmed by wage labor, agriculture would be more efficient, the nation would be more powerful.
And what was the fate of the dispossessed? You just talked about the creation of wage labor.
Yeah.
How did people survive at that point, and how radically were their livelihoods changed?
The English enclosures, according to many of the actual specialists in this area, the English enclosures was probably the most pervasive socioeconomic transformation of the early modern era, because it did a couple of things. First of all, it created these large consolidated farms in the countryside that would be farmed much more intensively. And so many of these tenants were either bought out by the estate owners themselves, or the tenancies were actually what they called ran out. These tenants were run off the estate and essentially turned out, much like somebody from a building today might turn out their tenants. And these tenants had nowhere to go. Many of them, sort of paradoxically or ironically, returned to their estates as wage earners. They were the ones who had farmed these estates for generations as tenants. They returned as wage earners, but of course not as many returned as had been there previously. That was one part of this. A second part of it, of course, and this is a very familiar story, is that many of these tenants were so-called freed up, as Karl Marx would say. They were freed up, and they became the early battalions of the industrial wage proletariat, who migrated into these newly emerging cities, Manchester, Birmingham come to mind, and they were the earliest of the new industrial proletarians that, of course, Engels talks about so vividly in the condition of the working class in England. Most of them, of course, came from the English countryside, and they were dispossessed by the English enclosures.
Gary Fields is my guest. We're talking about his book, Enclosure, Palestinian Landscapes in a Historical Mirror. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Gary, your book, Enclosure, looks at the plight of the Palestinians through the lens of the past, and you've just been discussing the enclosures in the English countryside starting in the 16th century. But then, starting in the early 17th century, something similar, you argue, took place in the New World, in colonial America, to do with the dispossession of the Native Americans. Tell us about that process and how was it justified, and to what degree was the way that it was justified related to how it was justified in the colonial home country of England?
What happens in England's overseas colonies is, in a way, a mirror image of what happens in England itself. The process simply begins a century later. And really, if you want to focus on a figure who kind of spans both England and England's overseas territories, you can look at the figure of John Locke. Mm-hmm. Now, Locke is generally credited with sort of developing a theory of individual property rights on the basis of improving land, the same logic that I mentioned a little bit earlier. Locke didn't really develop that theory. It was already quite prevalent by the late 16th and early 17th century. But what Locke did is he synthesized the elements in the English common law that were evolving to develop a theory of property rights. He kind of synthesizes it by 1690 in his second treatise of government. But what Locke also uses the enclosures as a point of reference, but what Locke also represents is he was an official with the Carolina colony. And much of his theory about property rights is written in the fifth chapter of that second treatise. Much of his theory about the rights to landed property is written with the example of North America in mind. Because what the English colonists do is that they bring this logic of land improvement, the idea that one owns land because one puts their labor into improving the piece of ground where the land is located. They bring that same logic to North America, and they use that logic to make a couple of key arguments. They use that logic to claim, first of all, that the Native Americans did not farm their land intensively enough to claim a property right over that land. And what the English do is that they use the logic of property, individual rights to land that they had developed during the English enclosures that had entitled estate owners to take over common lands. They use that same logic to argue that Native Americans did not have property rights in the land that they hunted on or migrated from, or even at times cultivated, because they did not develop a sufficient level of agriculture that would anchor them to the ground in a way that the English planter was anchored. So that they used a similar logic to justify their takeover of Native American land. So what you see in the North American case is the English colonists using the logic of individual rights to land, individual property rights that they had developed during the English enclosures, to justify the taking of Native American land. And even John Winthrop, the colonist from from Massachusetts in 1630, suggested that the Native Americans had no cattle, they had no fixed housing, they did not cultivate crops in a sufficiently regular and intensive way. Therefore, what Winthrop said is, if we take the land, then if we leave them a little bit, nobody will be harmed in the process. And the English basically use that logic throughout the 17th and 18th century to progressively dispossess the Native Americans of their land.
What role did divine will, i.e. God, play in the justification of the dispossession of the Native Americans in North America?
It seems that God always has some role to play in these stories. God appears in Locke's chapter on individual rights to land, because what Locke does is he references God Almighty in suggesting that what God had intended humans to do was to subdue the earth in pursuit of their livelihood, and to subdue the earth in the most intensive way possible. And that's how he justified the estate owners taking control of large tracts of the English countryside, because presumably the estate owners would subdue the earth in a much more rational, efficient, and intensive way than individual small tenant farming would. Now, of course, if God had intended humans in England to subdue the earth, he also intended Englishmen to pursue that same mission as colonists. So that basically what English colonists added to this idea of subduing the earth that Locke had developed in that chapter 5 of the Second Treatise, what God had intended humans to do is to subdue the earth. And therefore, the idea of English colonists subduing North America in the most intensive way was clearly what God had intended. So the English colonists also had a justification for their colonizing mission on the basis of what God had intended humans to do, both in England and in the New World.
What were the key mechanisms, technologies of force, to use the phrase that you use in the book, which mechanisms were crucial for the seizure of Native American land in North America?
Again, the mechanisms, what I try to argue in the book is that not only is the justification about improving land consistent throughout all three cases, but the technologies of force are also consistent in telling a common story about dispossession and the takeover of large parts of the landscape. What happens in North America is that English colonists begin to map North America in particular ways. We tend to think of maps as mirror images of land and landscapes. But really, what critical geography teaches us about maps is that maps are not just mirror images of landscapes. They are arguments about the lands. They are projections, not just reflections. And early English map makers of North America began to project their ideas about the English take about North America basically being English land. And this begins very early, and it begins actually with a couple of key maps. One of them by the explorer John Smith, who was also a very skilled cartographer. Smith's map of New England, for instance, uses a very, very tried and true technique of mapping to kind of project the idea of a piece of territory as being something imagined. When he maps New England in 1616, he maps it not as it is, not as he sees it, but basically as he imagines it, and that is as a part of England itself. He uses English names on his map. All of these places that he explored, he affixes English, what's called toponyms to that. Places like Cambridge, places like Sandwich, places that have very familiar English names, so that even the title of his map is called New England instead of the Native American name that it was known for at the time. it was certainly not. It was only New England in the eyes of New Englanders. So they use maps very effectively to project an image about this territory as belonging to England. And the culmination of this really occurs in a map that's done by the early 19th century by this cartographer by the name of John Mellish, who kind of projects a territory that put sort of uninterrupted all the way from the Atlantic to the Pacific without any mention or even presence of Native Americans on the map at all. So that the idea, the representation in the map is that this is a land completely English, under English control. They also, just like in England, they use the law very effectively. And what I argue in the book is that there are a couple of very key Supreme Court decisions connected with John Marshall that basically are absolutely critical in sort of as technologies of force. And the one that is really most notable is sort of first of all, the 1823 Johnson versus McIntosh decision. This is a Supreme Court decision that basically every law student is familiar with these days. And what Marshall's opinion in Johnson, and this is a decision in 1823, the decision was that Native Americans had never been owners of their land. They had always been simply tenants in North America. And so it basically removed any kind of notion of Native Americans as owners of the land that they used and which they hunted and where they farmed. So it basically changed the status of Native Americans from owners. And the colonists actually did treat them as owners at the outset because they couldn't simply remove the Indians. The balance of forces were such that they couldn't simply remove them until much later. And so they used the law finally to institutionalize the status of Native Americans essentially as tenants in North America. And that was a critical turning point in Indian removal, which occurs 7 years later under the President Andrew Jackson.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacific Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Gary Fields about his book, Enclosure, Palestinian Landscapes in a Historical Mirror. That book is published by UC Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Gary Fields is professor of communication at UC San Diego, and the book looks at the enclosure of Palestinian land by looking at past enclosures in England starting in the 16th century and the Native Americans starting in the 17th century. Let's turn to the question of Palestine and the enclosure that took place and continues to take place there. In the late 19th century, Zionists in Europe set their sights on Palestine and started to migrate to it. How did early Zionists regard historic Palestine?
The early Zionist movement in the late 19th century was really motivated by nationalism that had kind of swept the European continent and other areas. And they were really inspired by nationalism and believed that the Jewish people deserved a territorial container of their own. Now, many of the early Zionists looked at Palestine as a logical choice, but surprisingly enough, not all of the early Zionists were completely wedded to the idea that the Zionist movement should seek out some kind of national territorial container in historic Palestine. There were many other possibilities that they were looking at, including Argentina and Uganda. But Historic Palestine did offer some advantages in terms of the Jewish people believed that they had some historical roots there and that they had some justification for considering that territory to be in some ways belonging to the Jewish people. So after Herzl publishes the Jewish State in 1896, the Zionist movement actually went through some debate about whether Palestine was really the best possible place to sort of conceive of this project of statehood, because many of the Zionists actually knew that Palestine was inhabited by an overwhelming majority of people who were non-Jewish. And so, at the initial Zionist congresses, they discussed other alternatives, including Uganda. But they finally settle on Palestine by the early 20th century. And they think of Palestine as one of the advantages they have there is that usually historical nationalist movements look at history as something that will be the historical inspiration for that movement, and the Zionists were no different. They considered Palestine to be something that was very close to their spirit and soul in terms of Jewish history. There was a continuous Jewish presence there. And so Herzl began to imagine and conceive of the Zionist project for state building as a project that would target Palestine for eventual construction of a Jewish state.
What, in this case, were the mechanisms that allowed this to happen? Obviously, there's the period leading up to the formation of the State of Israel and then after the State of Israel was founded.
The early Zionists had this idea initially that they could perhaps purchase their way to statehood, with the idea being that through sufficient numbers of immigrants, buying up a sufficient amount of land, that could be the pathway to eventually creating a Jewish state. And so the early Jewish settlers, the early Zionist settlers to Palestine in the early 20th century began to purchase tracts of land, mostly from absentee Palestinian landholders, who had Palestinian tenants, by the way. But the purchases in relative terms were quite small. I mean, the overall amount of land that the Zionists managed to purchase, even on the eve of statehood, was really, really very, very small. And so they began to imagine, the Zionist movement sort of paradoxically enough, or not, maybe not paradoxically enough, emulated some of the same kinds of phenomena that we associate with the English enclosures and English colonization. They began to, for instance, draw maps of Palestine that projected this territory as a Hebrew national space. They appealed to British mandate, the British mandate authorities, who took over from the Ottoman authorities in 1917, to rename portions of Palestine using Hebrew names, and so they begin to put through all of these institutional mechanisms of a parallel state within the protectorate of the British Mandate, so that the British Mandate government from 1917 to 1948 actually sort of acts as a kind of protector of the Zionist movement creating a set of parallel state institutions, like a state developing within a state. And so through mapping this territory, they also began to what the early Zionists do after they purchase some of these territories, by the way, is that they begin to evict some of the Palestinian tenants on these estates that had been tenants there for generations. And there develops pervasive enmity between some of the early Zionist colonists of land and some of the tenants that had been displaced in that process. So some of the, and you know, all of course legal, so that the dispossessions that occur, the early dispossessions are completely, they have a completely legal framework to them, but there's enormous enmity nonetheless.
So do you think there is a link between the ideas that were used to justify the enclosures in England starting the 16th century and then to the British colonies in North America starting the 17th century to dispossess the Native Americans? And then, of course, you have a situation where, of course, the Zionists are motivated by their own ideologies, particular nationalist ideology of Zionism, but this is also taking place in British Mandate Palestine. Can one trace the transmission of a certain set of ideas from place to place, or is the logic more innate than that?
What I try to argue is I try to argue that there is a common set of themes in all three of these cases of dispossession. And there's an there's a common ideology to all three cases that, and this ideology goes back to the English enclosures, suggesting that the improvement of land is sufficient justification for entitlement and ownership of that land. So that logic of land improvement plays out in all three cases, because what the Zionists suggest very early when they begin to purchase land and they begin to colonize Palestine is that they make references to the fact that the Palestinians who farmed that landscape had basically neglected that land and had not done what God had intended humans to do, which was to subdue the earth. So there's a common ideological justification running through all three of these cases. The Zionists also use this idea of land improvement as pervasively, if not more pervasively, than the English estate owners and the English colonists, because they are constantly making reference to the fact that Palestinians are undeserving as owners and stewards of Palestine, because they claim that they had left, or the Zionists claim rather, that the Palestinians had left as an essentially barren and neglected landscape. Now, Palestinians, of course, believed that the landscape that they had cultivated in terms of olive and fruit trees was just as bountiful as anything that the Zionists had done. But they simply cultivated in a different way. What I argue also in the book is that in each of these cases, the development of exclusion on the landscape is a common theme. That is, that there, in all three of these cases, whether it be English estate owners, English colonists, or Zionists, what they attempt to do, and they attempt to create a new system of exclusion on that land, And this system of exclusion elevates their status as the rightful and justifiable owner of that land based upon the fact that they believe themselves to be the most capable improvers of that land. So the Zionists use similar logic. They use similar tools, maps. They use the property law. And they what I show in the book is that what they do in creating a Jewish landscape is that they are doing the same thing as estate owners do in creating a landscape of private property, and what English colonists do in creating a white landscape of white colonists. This theme, this is what enclosing land is about. It's about cordoning off a piece of land, creating a new system of exclusionary use on that space, and justifying that the creation of that exclusionary use and exclusionary system of ownership.
Gary Fields is my guest. We're talking about his book, Enclosure, Palestinian Landscapes in a Historical Mirror. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you have discussed how in each of these cases, in the enclosure of the English countryside, in the dispossession of the Native Americans in colonial America, and then in Palestine, that those who are doing the dispossessing, before they transform the landscape itself, which they do, they transform the landscape of imagination by projecting onto yes. places the names, that kind of aspirational sense of what the place should be rather than what it is. And I wondered, what role do you think those ideas, that imaginative geography term that you take from Edward Said, what role does that play in this process? I mean, clearly, part of it is harnessing a justification that allows you to seize someone else's land, along with the sorts of institutions and mechanisms that are necessary. But to what degree is that aspirational or imaginative projection and justification also meant for the dispossessed side? Because clearly, of the three, the dispossession of the Palestinians, particularly as it goes on into the 21st century or through the 21st century, is a highly contested affair outside of the region, in fact, throughout the world.
What Edward Said taught all of us, including myself, is that process of colonization, the process of imperial takeover of someone else's land, it's not just a material phenomenon. He acknowledged that colonization is, in the first instance, something motivated by materialist impulses. He made a concession to Marx, of course, in doing that. But he said that the process is much more complicated, because what the colonist has to do is that the colonist has to go through a mental conversion. The colonist has to reimagine the land that they covet somehow, and to reimagine themselves as the rightful owners and stewards of the land that they are seeking. And Said used this in many of his works. I mean, it's a key element in Orientalism, key element in his thinking on colonialism. And his idea is what you termed imaginative geography, that is, reimagining landscapes, was very influential to me in writing this book, because what I saw in all three cases is these groups with territorial ambitions all reimagining themselves as the rightful owners and stewards of the landscapes they coveted, and using similar kinds of justifications to explain why it was necessary, as well as desirable, for them to take possession of the landscapes that they were seeking. So I think this is
alongside the materialist impulse of simply wanting that land, I think this is a critical step in the whole process of taking possession of someone else's land. So, and indeed, this, and what I argue in the book is that this is a common theme in all three cases. All three of these groups with territorial ambitions, the estate owners, the colonists, and Zionists, all of them had some idea of why they were entitled to the land that they were seeking. And they all used a similar set of instruments to actually pry open those landscapes and to take them from groups already on the land. Now, ultimately, there's, and they used these kinds of subtle forms of coercion, and ultimately they are able to use more overt forms of force when necessary. All the law, for instance, is a technology of force that's ultimately backed by what we call the police power of the state. And they, all three of these groups ultimately do use overt forms of force in promoting their objectives. But they use these as a last resort or as a as something that is extremely outside of the primary of the main contours of everyday life. I mean, the Zionists, of course, use a war in 1947-1949 to ultimately wrest control of the entire area of Israel, of today's Israel. But they, after they settle into Israel, they use very, very coercive, but in a sense subtle technologies to actually wrest control of all of the land that Palestinians had managed to hold on to after 1948, and they managed to secure that land as well. So they do this as a way of furthering their imagined vision of what that landscape is and what it should be.
Well, let me end by asking you how that vision of what the landscape should be from the dispossessor, how does that shape the way the dispossessed see the struggle over the landscape? Because although you're arguing that the creation of this imagined geography is very forcefully about justifying the process of dispossession and making that dispossession right and just. But clearly, for those who are dispossessed, they see it quite differently, and yet their vision may be shaped by that relentless projection of who should own the landscape, why historically it should belong to the dispossessors, why it would be justified for them to have it. Are there conclusions you can draw from how that has shaped how the Palestinians have reacted and understood and struggled over understanding their place in this landscape where they're being forced out?
Palestinians have their own imagined geography of this landscape, which is quite different from the imagined geography of the Zionists. They believe that they are equally, if not more, entitled to that land. And one thing that is different in the case, in the Palestinian case, is that we see, even after a long period of time here, Palestinians are still struggling, despite overwhelming odds against them. They have a concept which they hold on to, an Arabic word called sumud. And this word sumud means steadfast. And the Palestinians, despite this extremely asymmetrical struggle in which they are waging, in which the balance of forces, the balance of power, is extraordinarily unequal. What is astonishing to me in all of the trips that I've taken there is that they They are continuing to try and hold on to what they have, and they will not be pushed aside somewhere else. I think there was a farming couple in the Palestinian West Bank town of Tulkarm, and the way they described it to me is that they said by planting crops, by farming, and they actually are this couple has actually become very famous in the West Bank as some of the most pioneering organic farmers in all of Palestine. They believe that by planting crops in this new way, by having establishing this kind of showcase kind of agriculture, by anchoring both themselves and their crops to the ground, that they are remaining sumud, steadfast to this small piece of territory that they are still holding on to. And I'm amazed at just how pervasive the thinking about sumud has been among Palestinians. They still continue to struggle. They still continue to believe that this land will once again that they will recover lands that they have lost, and that most of them believe that the land can be shared, that they can share this land just as much with the Zionists as any as with any group, and which is also an astonishing thought. So they are not going to be moved easily, and they are not going to give up easily, and they are continuing to promote this idea that this land is as much theirs as it is of anybody else's.
Gary Fields, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Professor of Communication at UC San Diego, Gary Fields, about his book, Enclosure, Palestinian Landscapes in a Historical Mirror, that's published by UC Press. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.